welcome again to the Fire Pro Wrestling Podcast. We're 4 episodes in. We're already on a Brian Alvarez vacation schedule.
Yeah.
of September 28th. And we've got a lot to go on about. But first, let's just do all the introductions again, if you don't remember us. I'm Brad Ritzy.
I'm Brian Rose.
I'm Dan Ford.
And yes, all joking aside, we love you, Brian. But basically, yes, so last week, if you didn't notice, which I'm sure you didn't, but we weren't here last week. A little bit of scheduling things, some technical problems kind of came up, and it kind of became kind of late. We were going to do result stuff, but once you kind of set come to Thursday and things aren't really going to, no one really cares about what happened the week before.
Yeah, I'll just
say
I'll say that the mask versus mask match was friggin' awesome. I'll just leave it
at that. Yeah, that was the Atlantis
match. Sombra. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything else is kind of generic, kind of going through. I mean, there wasn't really too much talk about the Sting injury was kind of the big thing, which we'll kind of get to eventually. But, I mean, interesting weekend. Go back and, yeah, definitely watch that Triple A show.
CMLL.
At least for that main event.
CMLL.
Yeah, CML. Sorry, jeez. Already off the great side.
Go see that show. For 2 hours.
That's the thing. I don't want... my CMLL, knowledge and watching is very, very low. I used to watch AAA years and years ago, and then I kind of was trying to get back in the last year, but apparently it's just awful.
CMLL? I mean...
Or AAA. So I kind of was requested or asked to watch this the CML show. Apparently it was supposed to be an iPay pay-per-view, but you could watch it on YouTube anyway.
Yeah, I ended up...
That's how I got it.
Yeah, I paid $10 to watch it, and it ended up being they put it on a YouTube page, and I guess they embedded it on a site. But if you went through the site and onto YouTube, you can just link it to everybody.
I think it's just didn't understand how you do paid content on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly.
You just put it on YouTube and thought, well, we'll charge people to go to the link, and then that'll be how we do it, not understanding people can link to it other ways.
Did anyone know what Dave rated that match? I hadn't really... I kind of just glanced through the real quick.
4 3/4.
4 3/4. Ah, yes, the Dave... Non-Japanese 5-star.
I wouldn't have given it 5 stars. I gave it 4.5. I mean, it was really, really, really good.
No, Dave is still
but not 5 stars.
The idea of just booking that match and taking the match off the Sombra.
Yeah,
the match was great, and it's just like, oh my god, you did something ridiculously stupid.
I agree. Yeah, and they brought that up too. We don't really need to go over it too much, but I agree with those sentiments. It kind of I get kind of why they did it, but. They have something with that guy, and I thought taking the mask off of him wasn't really the best thing. But the match itself was good, and it flowed really well. So I'm not too angry. Also, how much CML I watch, I can't really have a strong opinion about it. But then again, I'm a wrestling fan on an internet forum, so of course I can have an opinion about it.
This one's the worst.
It's the worst ever. But yeah, the main reason that we're all gonna go on forever and ever outside of what happened last week is. The Hall of Fame. Speaking of Wrestling Observer and Dave, his Hall of Fame is probably the most respected one out of them all. And mainly it's just an excuse for us to talk about old wrestlers and why we like them and hate them. So basically what we're going to kind of do is run down the current candidates for this year, and we'll kind of go over, not all of them, because we're not wrestling historians, not even close. So we're just going to kind of go over what we kind of like, what we don't like. When it comes to certain wrestlers, also there's that time thing where I don't know if we need to do a 7-hour podcast. Though I could just say talk about Big Daddy for that long. Who knows? we'll just kind of go over each one and kind of go from there. But it should be an interesting kind of thing. To go. You got anything to add before we kind of go through the list?
No, not really. I'm ready.
I think in general, I just want to preface this by saying the reason why I think the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame is the best is because they put a high bar on getting in. Like, obviously, WWE's is, are you making Vince McMahon? Are you going to be able to make Vince McMahon money at WrestleMania this year?
I mean, that's an emotional thing, yeah.
It's just a way to sell tickets to an arena the night before WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really a Hall of Fame in that sense. And then the other Hall of Fames I've noticed just seem to be, if you're alive, they'll put you in. Like, it's not so much like, oh, we want to put a high bar, because the Hall of Fames are sort of, if they're run by wrestlers, they tend to end up putting everybody in just to make everybody happy, because they're all in their 70s and their 80s, and they're like, you know what, let's let bygones be bygones. You're a Hall of Famer, too, and you're a Hall of Famer, and that's everybody be a Hall of Famer.
WCW Hall of Fame.
Yeah, are you one of our top stars' father? Then you get in.
What? Angelo Poffo was the greatest of all time.
Yeah, he was a tremendous, tremendous promoter, definitely. He was, oh, man, that promotion was a really well-run thing.
He did a lot of sit-ups, man.
Yeah, he was a sit-up king. But with the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, it's treated the way the Baseball Hall of Fame is, which I think in sports is the best Hall of Fame, because it's that this is a tough thing to get in, and it's not a black mark on your career if you don't get in the Hall of Fame. It's for the very, 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 very best.
Yeah, exactly.
Can't wait to talk about it.
Outside of, you know, certain child, you know, murderers that are in there, I think most of it's pretty decent.
Ty Cobb stabbed a guy to death, I think.
But he wasn't a toddler murderer.
He was a racist.
Yeah, but so was, I mean, he was even, I mean, there's a lot to get into. Ty Cobb, I mean, he was a racist for, in the time.
I mean, he was considered bad for his day.
Yeah, in the like 10s and 20s, he was considered a racist during the time when everyone was a racist.
So that's pretty extreme.
Like, yeah.
If you adjust for modern time, holy crap, that guy's Hitler. So, and you know, he caused riots by jumping into the crowd to attack people. Like, that's no good.
Yeah. Anyway, you should watch Ken Burns Baseball. That's great. But let's go on about wrestling here first. So, yeah, we're talking about, like I said, there's only each candidate there. We're going to have a lot to say about some and nothing to say about others. Feel free to make fun of us about our knowledge and call us noobs. That's fine. And let's just get right into it there. So we'll start off with the historical performers and just kind of go through a couple of them here. I'll just go through the list real quick, and we'll just spitball here. The Assassins, Red Bastien, June Byers, Cowboy Bob Ellis, Bob Jewell, Pepper Gomez, Dick Hutton, Rocky Johnson, Kenji Shibuya, John Talos, Enrique Torres, Von Bjornes, and Saul Wingeroth, Mr. Wrestling 2, Johnny Walker, Tim Woods, and Ron White. Right.
So, Bob Geigel shouldn't even be on this anymore. Like, I don't know how he's still getting on these lists. I guess it's for his wrestling. That's true. This is the historical performers. Okay, that's fair. Bob Geigel killed the NWA, though. So, I think when you're that big a moron, and when you run the worst territory in the history of the territory, we should all punish you, even if you were a decent wrestler. So, shame on Bob Geigel. Shame.
That would probably be the black mark, yeah. Killing the NWA. That's been going on since, what, 48?
1948, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't know, I think promoters stay on a lot longer, especially historical promoters, because of everything that's going on. I think there's a lot of, people have a lot of love for the territories that they watch at certain times in their lives, so I think you get a lot of connection between that. I'm more secret.
Surely nobody has fond memories of the Kansas City territory. Surely nobody. I mean, that was legendarily bad.
So, maybe.
I don't know.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. The big thing, though, is you got to remember, like, there are people who are nostalgic for everything. It's just based on age and the moments that you were kind of involved in. I mean, even, like, if you look on, like, the Figure 4 W board, there are some kind of users who are, you know, every once in a while they'll be nostalgic for, especially like the younger ones that we kind of see every once in a while, are nostalgic for like years that people thought were the all-time worst, right? Like we have people nostalgic for like 95 or, you know, like 2008. Yeah,
it's we're all in that age range, and it's like, but that's what I saw, and I liked it.
I liked early 90s WCW still. I don't know. King Mabel, he was the best. Why isn't he in the Hall of Fame? He's a king. He wrestled without his shirt on. He got with Lane Garcia. Very important. I wasn't even watching her at that time.
We have sidetracked this already. These historical greats. Legends of the wrestling business. Legends of the wrestling business. Such as John Tolos? John Tolos. He was a huge heel in L.A. And that territory doesn't have a great reputation.
No.
So I think, even though he was a big star there, and him and Freddie Blassie had that legendary feud, I think the fact that John Tolos didn't go other places and have huge runs, and the fact that his big run was in a territory that eventually had a bad reputation, I think that's why he's still on this list and not in the Hall of Fame.
That's why I think a lot of these territory exclusive guys are having a hard time getting in, because not only did they didn't travel, it's just that there's not enough like coverage, like television wise, across the United States. So not a lot of people know who Pepper Gomez or these kind of people are, because there's not enough like if you're really into historical wrestling, you know who they are, but in a post-1984 world, not a lot of people would know who they are.
Ron Wright should probably be in the Hall of Fame. Like, he had a money-drawing feud in that Tennessee, Kentucky, that eventually became Smoky Mountain, where Jim Cornette ran. And obviously he had a run as a manager for Jim Cornette's Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which I imagine is where most people actually know him.
That's where I knew him from.
Cornette's been on like a one-man mission to tell the world about Ron Wright, but like drawing money in the same little towns for like 30 years as a heel, Jesus, and then switching to babyface when the babyface in the area died in a terrible accident, and Ron Wright switched babyface, the hated heel turned babyface, Tennessee bullshit that everybody loves. Being able to do that, even though it's a small territory, being able to draw anything in a little territory like that for so long, Lord, I mean, Jerry Lawler's in the Hall of Fame for that, and if Jerry Lawler's in for drawing in one territory, obviously drawing incredibly well in one territory, Ron Wright seems like he's got a good case.
I mean, Lawler is different because of his tenure and not also involving doing the announcing and
he became a mainstream star.
He's not in as an announcer, though. He's in as a performer.
And
he was in the original class. He was in the 96 original class. That's before he even had the long run as an announcer. He'd only been doing the announcing for, two, 3 years at that point?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's the Kaufman stuff that got him in, and I think it's well-deserved. I mean, that's one of the most memorable things in wrestling and really in pop culture.
I don't know if the Kaufman stuff did get him in, at least not with Dave. It's not with that first, wave. I think it's because...
I think it was a part of it.
For a long time in this area, even though he was in
Memphis was a big territory. Memphis was a big territory. But get kind of back on to the current ones we're looking at. We talked before it started, but how do you guys feel about Tim Woods? Like, he was well known for, especially in the Southern kind of stuff. And Dan, I'm sure that you know more about him than anyone else here. But do you believe that maybe with that stuff and what he was involved in with Memphis and the NWA, do you think that he is enough to get him in?
I always don't know what to say about guys like Tim Lewis, because they're guys that I grew up hearing that this is a legend, period, end of story, because that's the part of the country I'm from. A big part of me being a wrestling fan was watching wrestling with my dad. It was a thing we watched together. I know some people watched wrestling on their own as a kid, but this was a father-son bonding thing, and he just thought Tim Woods was great and fantastic. And I'm from North Carolina. So I have a hard time not thinking of Tim Woods as a Hall of Famer, even though, you start looking at it, how many places did he really work? He had the big run in the Carolinas, and he had a big run in Mid-South. Outside of that, he was a big card, he wrestled in Florida a lot, and He wrestled in Georgia Championship Wrestling, so it's the, he ran all the big Southeast territories. But is that enough? And I think he was rarely the top guy. That's the thing you would say about Tim Willis. Rarely was he number one. He did have a run in Atlanta, I believe, where he was the number one guy. But then, his name just fell out of my head. The guy who won the NWA Championship with, and maybe traded blowjobs for it. Libel, slander. What was the young guy?
This podcast is over.
What was his name, guys? I'm going to sound like an idiot.
Yep,
oh,
God. And it's over.
Blonde fella. Buzz Sawyer. Oh, God. What was his name? Yeah, somebody take over. I'm dying.
That's who's like, oh, shit. All right. Brian, anyone else on this list do you think has a chance at all? Or anything. What do you think about, like, Rocky Johnson or, like, Cowboy Bob Ellis?
I'm not too sure about Rocky Johnson because, like, the only thing I know about Johnson is him teaming with Tony Atlas as the Soul Patrol. And they weren't that big of a draw in the WWF. I mean, they were champions, but that was at a time, like, when... I want to say business was bad, but it was like right before Hulk Hogan came in and everything took off. But I think he was a big Memphis. I don't know. It was. I think he was a star in the Memphis territory, maybe. But you know, I don't really know much about him before the WWF.
Yeah, I mean, it was mostly tag. You're right. It was kind of mostly tag. I mean, he did get around in the territories, you know, in San Francisco and Detroit and Mid-Atlantic. And I remember a little bit with George Championship Wrestling. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot of point. I think a lot of why a lot of people in our age to remember Rocky Johnson is because of the way that the WWF pushed him. In the sense of, you know, first black champion, blah, 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 blah. Which I know I can hear Dave yelling already from here about how that's completely untrue. I don't see him getting in. I'm sad for my fellow Canadians, and he's like, you know, used to live, you know, an hour away from me.
I didn't even know he was Canadian. He was?
Yeah, he was born in Amherst, Nova Scotia.
Huh. Okay.
Just like, it's like the south of Nova Scotia. There's like nothing there.
So the name I was thinking of earlier was Tommy Rich. Tommy. Yep. The podcast is already ruined. The guy on this list, on the historical list, that really jumps out to me is Red Bastien. Because of all the people of that era, if you listen to Flair, if you listen to Ole Anderson, who had very different ideas of wrestling, if you listen to Stan Hansen, all these guys who have very different understandings of what wrestling is or should be, they all go with Red Bastien was amazing. He was either the best or the second best behind Ray Stevens. And if you've got guys like that who don't always agree with each other, all going, this guy was legit, he was amazing, that should be enough, shouldn't it? I mean, it is. We've seen in the Hall of Fame, the Wrestling Hall of Fame, the Observer, is that the number one thing is, can you work? Are you a great worker? Like, there's obviously, there's the different criteria, there's drawing ability, there's...
But that can build, that all can that make the Hall of Fame. Like, if you're not a good worker, you probably won't get in.
If you're not a good worker, you have to be a tremendous draw for this thing, for you to get into the Observer Hall of Fame. And if you're a great worker, you can be a little weaker on the drawing power and still get in. And, I mean, Bastien, if he's not in, I don't know what... I feel like it's just basically because he didn't get in on that first go-through when all the legends got put in, and then there's just not enough people who remember seeing him voting. I think that's kind of the thing that maybe hurt him. But to me, that's the guy on this list who I would definitely go, yeah, that guy belongs in. The rest of them, it's just hard. It's just hard. If you didn't grow up in that area, you didn't grow up being told they were great, if you didn't get to see them, because we've almost got to see none of these people, because most of them are...
It requires a lot of research.
Yeah, there's almost no film or video from this era because they just didn't save their TV.
But like we mentioned, like we talked about before we recorded, a lot of these are historical candidates that even kind of, it's either territorial footage that we don't see anymore, or it's just, you know, we don't see them that much in the mainstream, so it's like you'd have to read somebody's book or find archival footage of these guys, and that's kind of hard to do. It requires a lot of research to determine if these guys would be a Hall of Fame candidate in a lot of these cases.
And I think that's a shame, and I would like to see Dave sort of put in something like baseball has the Veterans Committee for situations like this, because of the idea that they have their regular voters who try to span a lot of generations, but there's just certain people who may have slipped through the cracks who the voters of the day just don't know anything about. And it's nice to have, like, if he could put together maybe a couple of his historic, because Dave's very familiar with a bunch of wrestling historians, if they could put together a committee and put in maybe one guy a year off that committee, I think that would be maybe a good move for the Hall of Fame going forward. Because otherwise, I don't see how any of these guys are going to get in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's hard to say. I mean, everyone knows that Red Bastine, found Sting in the Ultimate Warrior. He was also the best man at Roddy Piper's wedding. But speaking of Sting, let's get on to...
A man called Sting?
No, I don't know who that is.
Oh.
I know who the vigilante Sting is, but I don't know who this man called Sting is. Sounds like a punk to me. I don't know that.
Well, listen,
but anyway...
He does this and he does that, and that's all he needs.
Alright, so the next one is kind of probably the one we're going to have a lot to talk about the most is the Canadian U.S. performers. Sting is on that list along with, for the first time, Brian Danielson, Junkyard Dog, Edge, Kurt Hennig, Ms. Perfect, Ivan Koloff, Brock Lesnar, Randy Orton, CM Punk, The Big Show, Paul White, I already said start to slot, AJ Styles, and The Ultimate Warrior. Let's just say, first off, you know, I'm gonna start from the last person I said, Ultimate Warrior, fuck him. No.
I mean, it always puts you over the dead, but that guy's in hell. No! Oh, I should have said that. Oh, God, no.
Now we're off the air. But outside of
Steve, is not kicking us off the air for any of
this. He might, man, I don't know. But anyway, outside of Ultimate Warrior being a giant homophobe, but I don't think a year or two on top, and an unsuccessful year.
He wasn't really a draw. Not in a draw like that. He drew big houses. I mean, I think people our age grew up on him, and he's well remembered. But, I mean, when he was champion, they weren't drawing that great. And then they took the title off him. Because the thing is that they were going to leave him with the title for, like, years. He was the next Hogan, pretty much. And business did not go well with him on top. So they had to take it off him.
Hogan must have been happy about that.
I know he said a lot of horrible things. And I'm not trying to excuse any of them. I try not to think about any of that because this is wrestling and a lot of people in this business have been scumbags of the highest order. So I try not to even consider that kind of stuff. So just objectively, as a candidate, Ultimate Warrior is a disaster and a terrible candidate because the realistic fact is WWF was maybe the hottest promotion in the history of wrestling in 1987, 1988.
Yeah,
you could maybe make an argument there's only been like one or two promotions in the history of the wrestling business hotter. Anybody they would have picked for that spot to groom would have been considered a big star and would have sold merchandise and done reasonably well. Nobody would have been completely a failure. So the fact that wrestling, that the entire drawing, when he was put on top, everything went down, that's about as bad as you could do, because just getting in that spot assured you a certain baseline.
Yeah.
Like, you were not going to go all the way to the bottom with anything coming off that era. You were going to have some kind of momentum, and they just picked the absolute wrong guy for the spot, 100%. They picked the worst guy they could have picked.
I don't know if I would say that, though, because the wrestling business didn't go down until, like, 1992, which was after Ultimate Warrior became champion, kind of flopped as champion. I mean,
I think some of that is just timing. You have a time, like when you got a guy who's getting at the end. I think Vince was right, see, looking at Hulk Hogan and going, I got to get somebody else ready because he's about at his end.
Yeah.
And
you pick the wrong guy, that guy flopped, and now you're left going, oh shit, now you're trying to recreate Hulk Hogan again, you know, trying to redo things for the guy who's run his course.
I mean, I get why they went with Warrior. I mean, he has a charisma that not a lot of people have. And I mean, he looked very good. I mean, he was a goddamn terrible wrestler by all counts, but
and terrible even for that era of WWE.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen
stuck out.
His feud with Hercules just freaking sucked.
That era of WWE was real rough wrestling.
Yeah.
But when you watched a Hacksaw Jim Duggan match back to back with Warrior, and Duggan's like the punching bag, right?
Yeah.
Duggan's matches, you go, okay, there's something happening there, and then Warrior, like, oh boy.
Ric Flair versus Lex Luger happen around the same time as Ultimate Warrior's push of the century, and that's one of the best matches of all time. So, I don't really have a point after that. I just wanted to rant that much, to be honest. It's great.
It's just that. You almost think if Vince had found Luger before Crockett did and put Luger in that spot, I think he does a million times better than Warrior. But he didn't see Luger, or he didn't find him first, or whatever happened, because I think the Crocketts had a little bit of a hometown. It was easier for them to find him because he was working in the Southeast. You know, he was living in the Southeast, I believe.
They found him in Florida, I think, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's where he started, at least.
So, you know, the fact that Warrior was in Texas and Pritchard had just come from Texas sort of helped them find Warrior. But, yeah, it's Warrior just was terrible. And even if he hadn't failed miserably, you're talking about a guy whose whole career was, what, 4 years all added together?
Maybe.
85 through 92. Then 96 and 98.
Working sporadically until he got to WWF, because it wasn't like he was working all the time. But he was the bottom of the card in Memphis and Mid-South. Like, he didn't start getting really any kind of serious push until Dallas.
Yeah.
And then WWF gobbled him up pretty quick. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, but I don't know. I mean, we're all pretty much the same thing.
I would say no.
I didn't like Warrior. But one of the more interesting candidates kind of come up, and Nick's been talking about forever, but we'll kind of just give it a little bit here, is Bryan Danielson, who's been basically the king of the technical awards for Wrestling Observer, and it's had, it's basically the old adage of top star to wrestling ability, and I think we've kind of already brought it up here before, where wrestling ability is going to trump all. I don't know if he's in this year, but he definitely will be in, and I think if you take away wrestling ability, I think if you remember the build to WrestleMania, WrestleMania 30, which was one of the best moments of any WrestleMania, I think he's a shoo-in. I don't know if it's now, but with his career being pretty much over, I'd say if he didn't come in now, he'll come in next year, but I welcome it.
If he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer in this day and age, then there's a lot of voters that need their mouths slapped, as my mama would say. There is nobody who is a no-brainer first ballot Hall of Famer who's come into this since the first one or two years that they were doing the Hall of Fame. Like, that's how just unquestionably this guy should be in the Hall of Fame. Like, just the fact that he's won the best technical worker every year for this Observer newsletter, my God, he is the undisputed for many years. You know, it didn't really start cooling off until like the last year or two, where he's barely working. Yeah. Every year it was like, this guy is the best wrestler in the business, in the ring. But he's not like, I'm going to bring up the bad man, Chris Benoit.
Uh-huh.
I think for some reason people always want to compare. People always want to compare Daniel Bryan and Chris Benoit, because Chris Benoit was the best technical wrestler of his day.
Yeah.
Chris Benoit had no promo ability.
I think Bryan does. Bryan's not a great talker, but he has a motion.
I would say he is.
He has a sense of realism that you can buy into.
Sure.
That not a lot of people have.
You know, I, think he's maybe not the best at doing, like, the Rock promos, which is now what everybody kind of thinks a good promo is.
Sure. Okay.
But he sells shows. And when he was in, you know, I always bring this up, because the Kane Daniel Bryan thing should have been the dumbest, worst, like, should have been worst of the year when they were paired up with each other. And instead, it was the MVP of every show they were on. Because
I don't know.
Daniel
Bryan
was so friggin' funny and so good at saving those segments.
I don't even like him winning that just because, with the injuries, what happened and nothing kind of stopped, it just seemed like that feud was just meant to kind of push Daniel Bryan up. You didn't really know what's going on.
I don't mean the after WrestleMania 30. I mean when they were a tag team and they were doing the Dr. Shelby.
I remember what you're saying. Yeah, I didn't watch them, so I can't say. I know basically Bryan Danielson from pretty much exclusively ROH and WrestleMania 30, which I came back around the time just the build up to 30. I think it was like December was when I kind of decided, like, all right, I'll see what's going on with wrestling, and then I started kind of going on and talking with you guys again, and it kind of built it up. So I don't have a lot of memory of that stuff, but I did go back.
It was WWE comedy, as you know what WWE comedy is. But somehow it worked because of Daniel Bryan. Like, Daniel Bryan almost single-handedly making these segments, you know, amusing and worth watching on a three-hour show. And I don't bring that up to be, well, he should be in the Hall of Fame then. But it's like, when you're talking about Daniel Bryan, people just want to say, oh, he's just a vanilla midget. And it's, no, he is absolutely not. He is everything a pro wrestler should be. He is, except the fact that he's like 5'8". And if he was 6'3", he wouldn't have spent as many years in ROH because he would have been in WWE immediately and he would have been a star for 10 years.
But he fought against that, and he won, and he main evented me, and he beat
Flair. That tells you, he broke every rule about what you're supposed to look like in the wrestling business, and got to the top. He was one of the main attractions in ROH when they were making a lot of money. I mean, obviously now ROH is doing really well, but at the time...
It wasn't for a time. Jim Cornette killed ROH, yes.
And even before Jim Cornette, they were going down. Because they lost Daniel Bryan. They lost, you know, the company was in a lot of ways built.
And CM Punk.
Like, when Samoa Joe and CM Punk both went to the major leagues, so to speak, Daniel Bryan, or Bryan Danielson, I get confused about what we're supposed to call him, enough without sounding like geeks. Bryan Danielson carried that company, and they continued to do well, and that was the final straw when he left. So, that's when they went into the dark times, and now they've come through that, but...
Well, it'll be interesting to see is what voters think, because, I mean, I'm pretty sure he'll get in eventually, but, I mean, for me, it's like, I didn't really watch a lot of his Ring of Honor run. I mean, throughout the years, I've always heard about what a great wrestler he was, and how tremendous he was, and, you know, looking at his Wrestling Observer accolades, I mean, he's won technical wrestler so many times. But for me, I'm most familiar with the WWE run. And, you know, it's like he did go and main event WrestleMania 30, and that was a big deal. But, you know, that was because there were so many other elements that worked in his favor for once. Because, I mean, WWE was never intent on pushing him as a guy, ever. I mean... Even after WrestleMania, they put him in a crappy feud with Kane, and they did everything in their power to kill him as a draw. I mean, but, you know, looking at his career overall, I mean, it'll be a testament to see what voters think in terms of indie drawing power. I mean,
yeah, I think that's gonna be interesting.
Yeah. Very interesting because, I mean, Ring of Honor was a very popular indie since its inception, but, I mean, how do Hall of Fame voters look at that in terms of being a very popular draw in a very popular indie promotion as opposed to somebody, you know, like Edge or Lesnar or these WWE guys who became names in the WWE, but you know, I'm not sure if they would, like, be really, really, really big Hall of Fame candidates, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think in general the voters need to, like, readjust what it means. Like, it's not like, well, if you draw 5,000 people, then you're a Hall of Famer. You draw 10,000 people, then you're a Hall of Famer, because the entire wrestling economy is completely different. And it was different before the 80s, you know, before the 1980s booms, when everybody was drawing 15,000, and everybody was drawing 20,000, and 30,000, blah, 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 blah. You know, in the 50s, yeah. They weren't drawing that many people. They were drawing in the same places every week, but, you know, and the wrestling economy of the past 15 years, the past 10 to 12 years or whatever.
It's drastically different.
It's just drastically different, and if you're able to consistently make money for a promotion in this world, you're a big draw. It doesn't matter if it's only 1,000 people, because getting 1,000 people has never been harder, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's essentially at that point, if that's the case and you aren't able to make it, whatever, then I think you have to be a very good wrestler. And I think Brian does that. It works for him.
I think he fits all the boxes.
Outside of the list here, we'll kind of keep Sting for last, because that's kind of
the main event here.
But
Sting's main event.
He's got a main event, and hopefully he doesn't injure himself. But there are a couple of those. I mean, like Junkyard Dog, I think Junkyard Dog's pretty awful. I mean, Edge is an interesting case as well. I think Edge has a very good chance, but I don't know if the current age of a lot of voters may kind of keep him out for a while, but he'll get in.
A lot of these guys are, well, all the guys from the 2000s except Big Show. Big Show.
I think eventually
the voters are going to hit that point where there's like nobody from the past 15 years who's gotten in, so they have to start looking at people like Edge, even though they want to hold their nose and not do that. Just the guys on the list who just know. I think we can just dismiss. I think Junkyard Dog. I know some people really. I think if you grew up in Mid South, I think you're gonna cape up for Junkyard Dog. And apparently, Junkyard Dog had a great run in Canada as a heel before the Mid South run.
Junkyard Dog was a very, very big draw in Mid South.
He was a legendary. Mega star. Well. I've heard that argued, too, that he wasn't really as big a star in Mid-South. He was a huge star in New Orleans, which was obviously their biggest city. But if you left New Orleans, they weren't necessarily buying Dog in Tulsa. They weren't necessarily buying Dog in different parts of that territory. But obviously, he was a huge star in New Orleans.
I mean, he's a shitty wrestler. I'm not going to deny that.
I don't think anyone is going to disagree with you on that one. He was very charismatic, though, but
he could be carried to something decent. I will say that. Like, Ted DiBiase got decent matches out of him. And, yeah, Ted's probably the greatest worker of his day.
He was a guy.
The argument of that day, and now this is a funny thing to look back on because no one ever considers this, but of the day, the argument was Ted or Ric Flair. Those are the two best. Pick one. And Ted had just as many people on his side as Ric did at the time. Ric obviously probably ended up historically, because he wrestled for 300 years, Ric ended up winning that argument. But at the time, that was a big fight. And Ted was having to get matches out of Junkyard Dog, so by God, Ted could work. But I think we can dismiss Junkyard Dog just because he only had the run in that one territory, and he flamed out, you know.
I think he was... would you consider him a draw in WWF at first? Because they knew by the end he wasn't, but...
He definitely was, but then it's just his problem.
As a mid-card guy, I guess.
He headlined for a while.
He headlined the B-Show.
Yeah.
Maybe. My WWF knowledge at that point is kind of back and forth. But either way, he won't ever get in the Hall of Fame. Especially not at this point. But I think you brought it up, Dan, about, you know, people like Edge, Lesnar, Orton, and Punk. They'll all get in eventually.
Lesnar's interesting to me just because if you're one of the people who just refuse to consider MMA and pro wrestling the same thing, or if you're just someone who just refuses to see MMA and consider MMA as part of Brock Lesnar, is he a Hall of Famer without MMA?
I think he is.
That's a kind of question. I think so. I think he's one of the most interesting people
of the new
era, and I don't know.
Has he really drawn in that spot? I mean, they pay him out the ass.
I mean, it's almost like they're banging up the ass just to keep him away from Dana.
He completely matters in today's WWE as a draw. I think he really does. And these last couple of years, I mean, without these last couple of years, I mean, he wouldn't be in. I wouldn't think so. But
he definitely makes the show more interesting, but yeah. I don't know how much he actually adds to the bottom line.
I mean, that's hard.
Maybe he really doesn't, from what all numbers I've seen.
It's hard to determine because, I mean, who is a draw in WWE right now? Is it more of a branding?
It's Cena, and that's about...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he gets match quality on his side, too. He does a pleasure must watch. I think that's going to happen. I think the MMA-leaning side is going to make him seem like kind of a bigger star. So I think he will have to get in.
I personally think you should consider the MMA, because I think it's... I'm one of those guys who think it's the same business, just one promotes real fights and one promotes fake. But that's my bias, so I just say that out of the way. And if you disagree with that, that's a perfectly acceptable thing to disagree with. I understand if people don't agree with that. But I would consider it, and I would say, yeah, he's all fans.
Yeah. I would not be surprised, and I'd be more than fine with him in. If he wasn't in for the reasons that you kind of talk about, I would shrug it off as well. I'd be like, all right, admit that. That at least I wouldn't agree with it fully, but it would be. What about AJ Styles? Do you think that, like, I don't think he's in right yet, because he hasn't been on top long enough, but do you think his TNA run hurts him?
It definitely hurts.
I don't think it hurts him, because he was on top of TNA for a long time. I mean, TNA never drew, not even once, but, I mean...
Joe Angle. Always have Joe and Angle.
Yeah. Well, that's true, but, even if you look at New Japan run, I mean, it's been so fantastic, and he's definitely mattered in terms of sales and drawing power over there. If he does that for a few more years, I mean, I think they're starting to become. I think he has a case now. I mean, the TNA run, I mean, no way, but with his New Japan run, I mean, he's starting to build that resume really well.
Personally, I don't think he should get in unless he has
a right now
in New Japan. But to me, he's like the classic what if. Like when you talk about Hall of Fames in sports, where you talk about the guy who just ended up on a garbage team and just never had the chance to produce at the same level. AJ Styles is that to me. It's like if there's an alternate universe where AJ Styles is an obvious first ballot Hall of Famer, but yeah, we don't live in that universe because we got doomed with what TNA actually was. But if the second company on TV throughout the 2000s had been a sensibly run company that actually looked at the wrestling business and said, what are the trends of this decade and not the previous one, and let's do that and make money off that, AJ Styles would have been a Hall of Fame.
When you put it in that perspective, I mean, how sad is it that somebody as talented as AJ Styles, who's completely blown everybody away for the last 2 years, well, it would be a year or a year and a half in New Japan, and you see how much TNA had in terms of just being the number two company and having this television time. I mean, it's really astounding how they wasted him for so many years with so many stupid angles.
It's so disgusting. I mean, it literally, if you think about it too hard and you don't just go, it's wrestling, I guess I shouldn't worry about it. But if you actually think about it, it literally will make your stomach turn about how freaking stupid it is.
Yeah.
And how preposterous, like how many people's careers they wasted, how much money they blew that they could have made, and really the harm they've done to the wrestling business, because how are you going to be, there's a genuine question about whether anyone will have a chance to be a number two, because it's been 15 years since there's been a viable number two. You know, is it going to be impossible for anybody to get legit TV like that ever again?
It's going to be very difficult because of the ad rates.
And landing, somebody was going to get Spike because Spike was so pissed off at WWE, and it ended up being that clown, that troop of assholes. Mm. And when is anyone going to get a chance at that ever again? Unless, you know, WWE and USA have a blow off. AJ Styles is the saddest name on the list, because you look at him and you go, he should be, but he can't be.
Maybe someday. I think there's definitely a question for just like Nakamura later, which we'll talk about later. I think he's kind of in the same boat where if he continues to go where he's going right now, he definitely win. Right now, it's hard to say. But speaking of TNA wrestling, one of the pillars of TNA wrestling for a long time was Sting. And Sting is one of, if I think Big Daddy's the biggest, I'd say, but it might even be Sting. Sting is one of the most controversial questions for, is he Hall of Fame worthy? And it's been discussed to death. I mean, the points are already kind of out there about, you know, is he a draw? So I think we're mainly just going to stick with our opinions on it. So Brian, if you were to say right now, Sting, because his career's over, based on all we know, Sting Hall of Fame, yes or no?
No. I mean, first off, he would have been in already. If people were so into him, I think they would have voted him in already. I don't know how long he's been on the ballot, but I think it's been a few years. I mean, just from my research, I mean when he was on top of WCW 1990 through 1993 and 94, I mean, that was some of the worst years WCW had in terms of business.
In terms of everything, yeah.
Yeah, I know people go, well, what about Starrcade 97 and all that? And I mean, yeah, I will give him that he was a big draw for Starrcade 1997. I mean, that did, like, tremendous business.
Starrcade was built well, but it really, a lot of it, like, I think you could have done that with anyone. I'm not taking stuff away from Sting in that point, and he was big, and even people, a lot of people of around our age know Sting. It's one. He's one of the wrestlers. Like, if you want to ask anyone to name five wrestlers, Sting would be one of them. But, I mean, a lot of it, the build was great. He was great in it. A lot of it was built for a long time. The ending ruined it because of, once again, Hulk Hogan. But I think you really could have put anyone in kind of like a paint and gotten a part of that. And I think it might have, it may not have worked as well, but it kind of been the same thing. So I think it's hard to say he deserves it based on those couple years when the business wasn't doing well and a single match that essentially marked the beginning and the end for WCW.
I say no for the same reason, but I say no with a heavy heart because I was a little stinger. I had my face painted with a headband at the show, just like everybody else in the Carolinas and in the Southeast. So I say this without, like, emotion. I'm not like, you know, it's not like some WWF kid who's like, fuck that guy, he wasn't as good as Bret Hart. I'm not trying to say that for some kind of emotional, because that used to be a thing, like the WCW-WWF rivalries with the fans. It's just, how are you supposed to put it any other way? Like, he's not an all-time great worker. I don't think anybody's going to claim that, unless you're delusional.
I think he was as good as his opponent.
He was good. I agree. I would say Sting was, and Sting was one of the most incredible athletes in the history of wrestling. Yeah. As shown by the fact that he's 56 and was able to have a match.
Yeah, like, he worked really well. He worked really well as a champion.
He is an incredible athlete, one of a kind. I don't think we'll ever see a guy that big, who's that quick, and can jump off the top, because he used to do the crossbody as like his alternate finisher back in the 90s, and it's like, oh my god, he's so huge, he's 250 pounds doing crossbodies. And obviously the Stinger Splash and the leaping and all that. So he was an incredible athlete, and if he was in the ring with Ric Flair, like a lot of people, he had great matches. If he was in the ring with Mick Foley, you know, Mick brought out the best in him. Vader brought out the best in him.
Mm-hmm.
He had great matches with Rick Rude. But he was also one of those guys. I mean, that the whole story of WCW in that early 90s, though, was that a lot of guys were just like, I'm getting paid. And this is, you know, this is shitty, and nothing makes sense, so I'm just going to go out there and...
In other words, if
he had a lot of those.
If he was working Hulk Hogan, he'd have a, you know, not a really great match. Or these other WCW main eventers, I mean... That 97-98 wasn't a good year for him or for WCW main events in general.
And to me, that big story is the Sting turn into, like, the black and white Sting was maybe the best angle WCW ever did.
Yeah.
Throughout 96, it was a tremendous story they tell leading up to that fall brawl. A guy who has trusted everyone. Like, that's the history of Sting, is that he trusts everyone and always gets turned on. And then the minute somebody, like some guy puts on paint, they all believe that Sting's turned on them, when Sting would always trust them. bullshit on y'all. And he leaves. It's just such a great angle, and I think that angle being so great is part of why people talk about him as a Hall of Famer, because he's in the middle of it.
Yeah,
the fact that the whole Sting main eventer heavyweight champion thing completely fell apart within months, like, that kind of tells you all you need to know about whether this is a thing that you should be investing in and going with, because it completely fell. I mean, Sting, they spent a year building to that match. They have the match. Sting wins. Yeah, obviously, everybody's talked about that match being such garbage.
I mean, that storyline fell apart during the match itself because it was so terrible.
It was garbage before the finish. Like people talk about that match as if the main event was screwed up and it ruined the match. No, it was ass from beginning to end.
Yeah,
that match should have been about Sting kicking Hogan's ass, but it was the other way around. And then the finish.
Everything about that match was ass. And for Sting to get this year-long push and then be nothing, and I won't say nothing, but to just be one of the guys within 2 or 3 months,
mm-hmm.
tells you all you need to know about Sting and what Sting inherently meant to that company and what Sting means as a Hall of Fame candidate. So, and then and from 99 and 2000, Sting was often involved in the worst shit on the show. And obviously you can't bring up anything from TNA because that was basically just him getting paid to sit around and jerk off.
I think in TNA, I think he worked hard. I mean, I wouldn't say like he was like awesome or anything, but you know, I think that was more creative than Sting not wanting to be there.
I think the joke was if he was getting the title, then he would juice up and not wear a shirt. Otherwise, he's wearing that T-shirt every week.
Yeah,
he's gonna go out there and wear that T-shirt.
Yeah.
But if TNA gave him something to sink his teeth into, he'd get strong. He'd get in good shape for it. That rarely happens. So most of the memories of Sting are him with a receding hairline and an oversized T-shirt. Except when he suddenly became the Joker, and that was maybe the high point of TNA. As a comedic promotion, but Joker Sting was the best, y'all. It's for a guy who's been in a major company, either the number one company or the number two company in North America, for most of the last 25 years. There are so few moments of like, oh, this was a big feud, or oh, this was a huge moment, or oh, this was a huge thing he did. Like, you go through somebody like Shawn Michaels' career. And you can go, this huge match, this huge match, this huge match, this huge feud, this huge thing. And with Sting, it's like, well, it's Mick Foley, and it's Vader, and it's Flair. And then it's the Crow Sting thing. And that's it. In 25 years. And I don't think that's a Hall of Fame.
No.
I would compare Sting to a guy to a guy who played on, like, the New York Yankees for 20 years. So you go, well, he must be a Hall of Famer. But it's like, well, yeah, but he hit 260. And he never hit more than 15 home runs in a year. And it's like, yeah, he was there forever, but what does that mean? Basically, he's Scott Brosius.
And the emails start coming in. And mailbox full.
I have a full article on Voices of Wrestling. I think it's going to be up soon. It's going to go into more detail about this, but... I mean, just to summarize, I mean, like everybody said, I mean, he had a few main event runs. The main event run in the early 90s flopped, and then they pushed him again in 97. I think if they didn't do the crappy finish and, you know, the booking, I think he would have been one of the bigger main event draws, but it didn't, and he flopped, and, you know, what can you say? I mean, the latter one's more of WCW's crappy booking. I mean, I think if they would have had him win at Starrcade 97, I mean, they did have him win, but I mean, in a more convincing fashion, I think that there would have been something there, but I mean, that's talking about, like, what ifs and stuff like that.
It's sort of the same thing we said about, or at least we said about AJ Styles. It's like, there's an alternate universe where, like, the Turner-run WCW was always a well-run company, full of smart people. And when they bought the company in 1989, Sting became their guy, and they pushed him exactly right, and he was the main eventer. and everything was great for the next 10 years and everything was wonderful. And then he'd be a Hall of Famer, but that didn't happen. It was not. And spoiler alert, I'm going to make the same argument about Randy Orton in about 5 years, probably. I mean, you want to give Randy Orton some time because maybe his career's not over because he's obviously still in pretty good shape. But I kind of had the same thoughts about Orton that I have about Sting. It's like, it's a lot of years of being top mix and then nothing really getting done or getting accomplished.
I think Orton will win by medical. You know, he's one of the most consistently decent wrestlers they had.
Decent, yeah. I mean, decent.
I think Sting was pretty decent, too.
If you were to build a wrestler from the ground up,
yeah.
I would pick a guy who doesn't shit the bed in a WrestleMania main event.
I wouldn't blame that on him, though.
Oh, I would. That match was ass.
Yeah, it was. I mean, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But,
If The Miz and John Cena hadn't done what they did, that
match,
we would all be talking about Randy Orton, Triple H, is the worst main event in the history of WrestleMania.
Well, Orton is only 35, so I don't think he's going to be in now, but he'll get it.
I don't think he'll ever get in.
I don't think so either. I mean, at 35 and how long he's been in WWE, I mean, they might go with him again because it's WWE, but...
Well, the story of Randy Orton is that they gave him that, like, 10-year contract where they pay him a pretty good guarantee. So, it's like, they're always going to put him on top.
Yeah.
Because they're paying him. But
I mean, it's just one of the guys they pushed for so long. I mean, a lot of people like to crap on him about being the crappy worker. I mean, I never thought he was crappy. I thought he evolved into a pretty decent to good worker. Yeah, he has this...
Oh, come on.
He has this style. I mean, I wouldn't say he's, like, fantastic at a level like Edge or even Lesnar or Punk, but, I mean, he could have a good match.
Yeah, he can have a decent match with just about anybody in the
world. Yeah.
And I've never seen him have a great one with anyone.
All that.
I've never seen a great Randy Orton match. In fact, he probably... If he hadn't been wrestling John Cena so many times, John Cena maybe would have gotten a little bit better reputation sooner. But it's like when you're wrestling that guy who never gets out of third gear, like, no one is going to think you're any good. I'm just not a big fan of Randy Orton in general. And as a talker, he's maybe the worst talker in the history of main event pro wrestlers in America.
Well, that's not even true. Remember when he did that crazy stuff? When he's crazy, face Randy Orton like he is now? It's great.
Yeah, I think it's him and Lex, and he's had a longer run than Lex.
For some reason, I thought he was a pretty good talker, like, when he first broke out, like, in 03 or 04, but after that Raid RKO stuff and they went with this current character, I mean, they go out of their way to script him with some boring-ass lines, and his delivery's not very, very interesting at all.
Read his star ratings, man. Read his star ratings. You'll know that he is great. Forget, he's consistently good.
He's consistently good.
Great.
No, this is not the Hall of Very Good.
No.
This is the Hall of Fame.
He's had many famous matches. He is...
Like, such as list these famous Randy Orton matches.
Well, you know what? The Mick Foley matches with him were really good.
It was all Mick.
I
was midget dragging it out of him. And obviously, that's not even Randy's fault. Randy was so green. It's like, at the time, we thought, my God, he's so green. And then Foley just pulled these great matches out of him. Think about how great he's going to be when he's actually, like, polished. And it's
Yeah.
Consistency needs to be lauded. It does. All right. So, that's pretty much everything for U.S. Canada.
And Punk should be in. I'm going to say that. Punk should be in.
Punk's in my third tier match. Samoa Joe, CM Punk, too.
The reason why CM Punk's not in it is because, again, people haven't adjusted to the fact that he's a huge draw in ROH for what their economy could possibly be. And the fact that he was able to work his way to the top in WWE despite having none of the characteristics they usually want and being an asshole.
Faces have done so well with him by forcing him to drink beer at the end of matches that he deserves being in the Hall of Fame.
He's had great. This is the difference between Punk and Orton. Orton never screws up stuff, and he's always competent, and then there's the end result is, okay, there's a match. CM Punk a lot of times fucks up little things, but then you can name these like amazing matches he's had where the crowd was losing their shit and throwing babies in the air.
Exactly.
And I'd rather have the guy who causes the babies to be thrown in the air than the guy who people go, oh, yes, I will adjust my monocle. That was a very good match. Huh? Because that's Randy Orton. Like, Randy, he's a wrestler's wrestler. I don't want to see a wrestler's wrestler. I want to see a wrestler who puts people.
I'm more classy than you is all I'm hearing here. I'm more classy than you, and I know where the most classy wrestlers are, and it's Randy Orton.
I mean, I would vote in for Punk because, I mean, he's just, like you said, Dan, I mean, he wasn't technically a great worker, but he worked his ass off, and he had fantastic matches with a lot of guys in WWE, and also in Ring of Honor. I mean, again, I didn't watch Ring of Honor during his run with the promotion, but I mean, if you include the drawing power he had in Ring of Honor, and I don't know if I would call him a draw in WWE because that's harder to determine. But
I think
with the merchandise and all that, he was at one point. So I would probably vote him in. I think he has my vote. I'm pretty sure, yeah.
I don't know.
I think because of the way WWE's been run wackily, we'll say, for the last 13 years, if you're not someone who looks the way Vince McMahon thinks a wrestler should be and you make it to the top, that's a sign.
I think Punk did even more so than Daniel Bryan. I think he really, really worked his ass off to get there, and by some luck, he did. I mean, for both Punk and Bryan, it's about luck in getting to the top, because even if you're that great, I mean, I don't know if it was so much more, I think with Daniel Bryan, I think there was more of an incentive to de-push him because of his size. But I think with Punk, it's like, I mean,
I don't think it was luck, though. I think it was.
They went
with Miz, and Miz was one of the biggest failures ever. And then they went, well, shit, we got nobody. Or they looked around, and then here's this guy who always hit the ball when, you know, he's the guy that they're batting eight, and then he's always getting on base. And so they went, well, shit. And Punk was like that classic, like that WWF locker rooms always had that cutthroat culture where you got to go grab things and grab the brass ring, so to speak. CM Punk went and grabbed brass rings, and for years was reaching for it, and I think they finally realized that they were in such a shitty position, they had to.
He was highlight of ECW for a while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if there wasn't ECW, I mean, you know, I mean, literally, I mean, who knows if he would even have been called up.
Yeah. I mean, it's all Paul Heyman even getting him called up in the first place.
Yeah, because of Paul Heyman, I mean, he got them. I guess attention would be the good word. The attention he got in ECW, and then he got over on the SmackDown brand. I mean, on Raw, I mean, they put him as world champion and all that, but he was, I don't think he was pushed as a top guy, not until SmackDown run.
He got over to the highest he could get over every time they put him in a spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And they often put him in a spot where you could only get over to blank level. And he got to that level.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they were in a position where they didn't have any other choices, and he knocked the wall down. He broke those walls down, just like Chris Jericho. So I think CM Punk's a Hall of Famer, and I'm going to say that to my dying day.
I hope not, actually.
I hope that's not my dying words. CM Punk's a Hall of Famer, Rosebud drop.
What a pathetic
existence.
He died doing what he loved.
Doing what he loved.
With CM Punk, I guess. I don't know. Much like CM Punk himself. He talked about CM Punk.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
CM Punk, guys. Yeah. How you doing? Dr. Whatever is a bastard. Oh, we're sued.
Dr. Amon? All right. We're already ready to talk here. Alright, so we gotta
fill time because we're gonna get to like Mexico and all go, I don't know. I guess. I saw Hector Garza in TNA once.
Oh, yeah. All right, so. See, again, we pretty much went through all of them. Let's talk about the Japan candidates. I'm not going to list them one by one because I refuse to make a fool of myself.
I can try.
Find them. We'll post them all up there. All right, Dan, go ahead.
I can try. Okay. We have Jun Akiyama.
Mm-hmm.
Sima. Okay, this is the one I can't do, and it's the one that's not Japanese. George Gorgenko. Volkan. Masahiko Kimura. Satoshi Kojima and Hiroyoshi Tenzan as a tag team.
Yep.
Yuji Nagata. Shinsuke Nakamura. Mike and Ben Sharp.
Yep.
Minoru Suzuki. Kiyoshi Tamura. And Akira Tawa. Someone will tell me I screwed those up, but I gave it my best.
Do you know anything about Japanese wrestling? Jesus.
Do you even watch anime?
Come on, man. Yeah, it's from Japan, too. I saw one episode of an anime once. All right. Here's the part for the next few things where we don't really talk about a lot of them. I think there's a few on the list here that we'll kind of hear, but I think one of the big things and one of the big additions this year is Nakamura, who has been quite the star in the last couple of years. Has been champion before, was champion during the time when New Japan was, let's just say, awful, not very good.
No, keep crazy.
It made me not want to watch New Japan at the time.
When I know he went through the thing that Vince has been going through recently, where he just loses his mind.
Recently?
And they gave, like, Lesnar and Muto, like, I kept giving Muto that title. It was, like, 2005 they gave him the title again?
I think it was, like, anyway. 2003, and that was, like, a year into his career.
Yeah.
It was really so soon.
I think Nakamura goes a lot with the kind of groups where, the AJ Styles and of what they're doing right now is definitely Hall of Fame potential. But he's going to have to do this for a long time before I'm kind of convinced. He's one of the best wrestlers right now, but he needs to be
up. And you wonder if his body can handle. That's the other thing we didn't even mention with AJ Styles. Is these matches that they're having in New Japan are so physical.
Yeah.
Like, how long can these guys really go while working style?
And he's like 35 already.
Yep. None of those guys are really young. They're not old geezers, but they're not young'uns.
It's 35 and working that style. That's really taxing on the body.
Nakamura kind of reminds me of Eddie Guerrero, where it's like a guy who was really bland for a lot of his career and then suddenly gets the whole charisma aspect of wrestling, and you almost can't even remember that they were different.
Yeah.
You can't even believe it's the same guy sometimes.
He went to Mexico and then he came back and suddenly he had charisma. Funny how that works.
I think if you're talking about who's the best in the business today, I think Nakamura is going to be in your top two or top three.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's one of my favorites right now, for sure. I mean,
I wouldn't vote him in yet because he's had a few years as a draw. He's definitely a draw in New Japan, that's without question. And he's definitely improved his style, and he's just super charismatic, and he's an excellent worker. He's one of the best right now in anywhere. But I mean, I think he needs a few more years of that, because for a long time he wasn't any of that. I mean, from what I understand, because I didn't watch it back when he first started out, but from what I understand, I mean, he was good, but he wasn't great. He wasn't charismatic at all. He was kind of bland. I mean, they pushed him.
It's so amazing to think about.
Yeah, it really is. But, I mean, in terms of drawing, I mean, I think that was some of the worst era of New Japan was during the mid to late
2003, 2009.
Yeah.
It's kind of when that was kind of off for me.
I mean, Inoki went off his rocker and started booking these weird MMA matches with guys who weren't over at all. But I mean, once Inoki left and once they started like rehabbing the promotion, I think there was better workers, but I mean, he wasn't even, still, he wasn't even that great until, like, what, 2011, 2012? Yeah. I mean, he needs a few more years, in other words.
I think you can give him and Tanahashi also a lot of credit for helping to boost Ring of Honor back, because that's one of the things that's led to Ring of Honor becoming this hot promotion again.
Yeah. Yeah,
in America, has been that. Those New Japan guys coming over and doing those shows. That's what got them, you know, when the dark times had hit and the Cornette era had really bottomed out, those Japanese guys coming over from, you know, the top New Japan stars coming to America really is what lit that business back. So I think he deserves credit for that, along with, you know, the other top guys there at New Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that should be considered, because, I mean, a lot of people were saying Ring of Honor was doomed after Cornette left, but... I mean, I wouldn't say it's directly because of the New Japan, but it was because of one of the parts was the New Japan affiliation and bringing all those guys over.
And the main thing is that if those guys have a reason to stay in Ring of Honor, because New Japan's where they make a lot of their money. Like, the Ring of Honor American talent can go over there, but yeah. If Nakamura wasn't coming over to Ring of Honor and Tanahashi wasn't coming over to Ring of Honor, I don't know if Ring of Honor would still be around. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So,
and
I think he deserves credit for that.
It also shows that their international draws as well. I think that's... I mean, Tanahashi's already in, of course.
Yeah.
Tanahashi.
Yeah.
And I think... But, I don't know.
I think Nakamura crosses over better than anybody else in that New Japan. I think he's the one where you just see him and immediately, oh, well, that's a star. Like, you don't even have to hear him talk. You don't have to have a translator. You don't have to have any idea what he's saying.
The way he carries himself.
I would compare it to Kobashi, because I think Kobashi had the same thing for the All Japan guys in the 90s, where it's like you saw him and went, I don't know anything about what he's saying, obviously, because I don't even speak his language, but there's just an emotion, and there's an intensity, and there's a charisma that he's giving off that I'm picking up on that speaks a universal language.
Yeah. What's so weird about Nakamura is, I mean, you always hear about it. Like, you can't teach charisma, or, like, you can't, like, suddenly have charisma one day, but he's, like, one of the rare exceptions. Because he sure wasn't, I mean, I've seen some of his stuff before, and he sure wasn't charismatic at all, but then he just found it. It's weird.
And I think it also speaks to maybe, you know, not to make everything about WWE, but it's like WWE signs a bunch of guys who are like 22, 23, mm-hmm. and if they don't have it by the time they're 26, they just give up on them.
Drew McIntyre.
Like, yeah, and it's like sometimes these guys don't get it till they're 30.
Yeah.
And you just waited or didn't put them on TV when they didn't have it and let them sort of simmer and then bring them in. Like, you might end up with a Nakamura on your hands. Or you let him go away or do something else. So, I mean, he's amazing. If he can do this for a long enough period, he will get in.
Mm-hmm.
But you just have that question mark of whether he can keep working with style.
It'll be interesting to see.
Overcome his previous not-so-goodness.
Yeah. I think with a few more years, he'll be a lock.
Yep, if he keeps up with it. As long as his body keeps up with it, I think he will be too, but
mm-hmm.
I need to see it first. But also on this list here, in closing check case, Suzuki was on an episode of One Piece, therefore he deserves being all in. I will have no further discussion about this.
I know he's a fan of that, but I didn't know he was actually in an episode.
Yes, he was in an episode. Suzuki's one of those people that he's so popular in Japan.
I'm stunned that he's not in.
It's I think a lot of it has to do with length. Cause a lot of his time was in MMA, right? It's the same thing with Shibata, right? Shibata's currently my favorite wrestler, active wrestler at this point, right? But I think a lot of it too is just they had a lot of time in Pancrase and things like that.
Yeah, but I would think with observer voters that would help them, not hurt them.
Yeah,
I'm just kind of stunned. He seems like you talk to people who are like, you know, read the Observer, and like almost invariably the favorite Japanese guy is Suzuki.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's keep in mind, he's so unique.
Yeah, keep in mind as well, a lot of Suzuki's career before the last few years was with All Japan, which didn't have as much reach when it came to a lot of people, because All Japan was better at that time, between, like, you know, just in, like, 2005, 2010, but it kind of had the same kind of problems. And I think Suzuki, since he's come back to New Japan in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, is really when people are going, all right, yeah, I remember why this guy's awesome. So
I think he's always sort of had that thing where he's ended up working for everybody at some point or another. Like, he's got a little bit of a Tenryu thing, where he pops up everywhere. Like, he'll pop up on a Noah show, he'll pop up on a New Japan show, pop up on an Old Japan show, you know, and he's usually the best thing on it or the second best thing on it, you know, unless it's a really good show. Drawing power, I'm not as well equipped to judge that, but my God, everybody loves him, so I'm kind of stunned he's not in.
I think he's helped Noah in the last year. I mean, Noah was on its last legs before New Japan took over, and they did that invasion angle with Suzuki Gun. But I mean, as a worker, I think he's in. I mean, I think he's a really fantastic worker, and he knows how to get a great match out of anybody and works a style different than anybody else. Yeah. That's really unique.
I would think that would help him because there's just nobody like him.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, even if nobody like him, right, there's Suzuki. Other guys who sort of work a little bit like him, so maybe you can get fooled into maybe not seeing it. Suzuki, but no one else does what he does.
No. He's a very, very unique worker. I mean, like, I can't judge what he did before I started watching New Japan, which was, like, 2012. But he's been around everywhere. I don't know how he'd do as a draw. I mean, I don't think he was, like, a very, very big draw at all. But as a worker, definitely, I think he's in. But, like, overall, I mean, I think it's going to be one of the tougher things for him to get in, but again, I think it's like, let's see in a few years. Like, let's see how Noah does for the next couple of years. It's still like,
he's old as dirt, but
I think how old is he? Like, 45?
Yeah, he's like 47.
If he keeps
it, also doesn't work the same kind of style.
Yeah, he doesn't work like back-breaking matches like other New Japan main eventers do. He works a very different style. I think he could go for a few more years.
He could be a Tenryu, where he's still going, like, it's only 58.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
if he makes it to that, he's a no-brainer. He is a complete no-brainer.
Yeah, I would agree.
If he just keeps it up. Now, this is a bit of a nostalgia thing for me, because he was one of, like, the wrestlers I watched as kind of a kid, but Akira Tayu, long career, was one of the kind of the big tag team guys in All Japan. Always, like, I think he has, let's just check, he has 14 five-star matches. So I think his matches speak for himself. I get that maybe it's kind of the draw thing. I can't really speak for that too much, but I mean, as a star, I think that, you know, he's great. What do you guys feel about?
Well, here's a question. I mean, I don't know a lot about Tawai because I haven't watched as much All Japan in the 90s as probably you guys have, but would you say that he was a big part of those five-star matches, or is it like, well, Kobashi and Misawa and all these other guys were in it?
Yeah, I mean, some of it was with Misawa and Kobashi. That was a bit. I think that's the Misawa Kobashi was probably a lot of the reason why a lot of these matches got five stars, because we know how much Dave loves Misawa and Kobashi, as he should.
Yeah, they're fantastic. What do you guys think of Tawai as a worker, like, on an individual level?
He just doesn't have a ton of those. Like, there's not a ton of, like, Tawai singles matches where you go,
no.
Whoa, baby. I mean, he did have a few, but a lot of times it's with the Misawa, Kobashi, Kawada guys, and it's like, well, I can't think of too many matches any of those three guys had that weren't amazing.
Yeah.
So, I think the issue with Tawai is always going to be that he was supposed to be the big star. Like, that was the guy Baba was grooming.
He was tall.
And then everyone shot by him. Yeah. You know, all three of those guys shot by him.
Yeah. No, so I agree.
It's hard, you know, it's hard, and I think that's kind of what hurts his Hall of Fame candidacy. Because he's got the matches. Like he's been in the, he's got the match quality. Although again, you have these questions about how much is it him, and but he's been in enough great matches that he could that he has a Hall of Fame case. But
yeah,
you just can't get past the idea that all those guys just rocketed past him. And maybe that's not fair. Maybe it's not fair to, you know, oh my God, I wrestled in the same promotion with Terry Funk, Ric Flair, and Harley Race, and so I'm not a Hall of Famer. Well, maybe you are, you know, just because you had three other Hall of Famers wrestling with you, you know, that don't mean you're not a Hall of Famer. I don't know, but I sort of lean towards no just because of that. I think Akiyama has a better case because he had a more of a singles run than Taue, and you can see more of what he's putting into the match. It's not just like, well, he's one of four guys, and the other three are great. It's him one-on-one with, you know, with those guys. And I still don't think Akiyama belongs in, but I think he has a better case.
With Akiyama, is it like the drawing aspect? Because from what I hear, I mean, he's like one of those Kurt Angle cases where he was excellent from, like, the first day or first week or whatever.
Yeah, but I don't think...
Yeah.
He was still always below those guys.
Yeah.
It was like... With Akiyama, when he first showed up, everybody was like, oh my God, he's going to be amazing. And then he was at that level for his entire career, which was a great level. Like, like he was great immediately, but it's not like he got better and better and better.
Mm.
Yeah, I just remember Akiyama from NOAH, which was, that's kind of what I remember for. And he was really, really good.
He was also the champ when they hit the iceberg.
Yeah.
Yeah, like... And Taue is for me, like I said, it's kind of all jokes aside, it'd be pure nostalgia vote for me. Like, I guess I remember a lot of them. It was a lot of fun to watch. But Akiyama is an interesting one. It's one of those things where, like I said, I can get why he wouldn't be there. If he was there, I would be too surprised. But if he doesn't get in, then it would be the same thing.
Alan, over at WrestlingObserver.com, figure4online.com, Alan made a great argument for Akiyama that made me sort of reconsider things. So I would encourage you to go look up that episode of the Dr. Keith Presents.
Yeah, I remember that. That was really good.
He and obviously Alan is the Japan guru. So
it's
smarter than us.
When he speaks, definitely. You should probably listen to him, especially about Japan. But I just can't get over, you know, and he's argued that, well, Akiyama's champ really didn't do so bad, and a lot of their issues was more that, you know, maybe Misawa was sort of taking his eye off the ball a little bit as a booker, but you just can't get over the fact that you're the guy on top when the thing goes down the toilet. And that's the thing that just sticks in my head, and I can't get over. But then again, it is a wrestling Hall of Fame, and as a worker... I think he probably is a Hall of Famer. So maybe he should be.
Mm-hmm. And the more I kind of think about it, the more I'm just like, you know what? Yeah, those were pretty good. I remember like some of those water matches, and I remember his like defeat with Bashi and stuff like that. Like him and Noah was really, really good. So.
I can't help but think, you know, as we're going through this and discussing it, when you're talking about Akiyama and you're talking about Taue to a lesser extent, it's starting to remind me of the arguments we used to have about Shawn Michaels before he got in. And it's like, but he didn't draw well enough, but he's the best worker of in America. But he didn't draw enough, but he's the best.
Yeah.
And obviously, but Akiyama and Taue aren't the best, but they're close. You know, they're in that, you know, Akiyama at least, he's in that run. You know, he's within a couple standard deviations maybe of it.
I think Alan wins. Right.
Yeah. I think Alan's maybe winning. I think Alan's arguing me into it without ever even talking to me once. I think me just summarizing his opinion is starting to win me over. So
we're pretty tight. Anything else from the Japanese candidate?
Well, I think we should talk about Seema because he's the first. This is his first year that he's in. So. I mean, he's an interesting entry into the ballot because, I mean, he's been I guess you could say he's been the top draw in Dragon Gate for many years, but, I mean, how does a top draw in Dragon Gate do in terms of voting?
Yeah. And he also... see, this is the thing, is I don't really watch Dragon Gate. It's not a promotion I paid much attention to. And I kind of don't even like the Dragon Gate style. I know some people might get mad at that, but... I still look at it and I go, they've done pretty well for, you know, for a startup wrestling company at a time where Japan was really on its ass.
They are the number two company right now.
Yeah, they've done pretty well. And SEMA being their top guy for most of the years, and kind of their signature guy, I mean, this might be one of those things where I'm just ignorant and I'm just looking at it going, well, it seems to be doing well business-wise. Maybe he is a good candidate. And if somebody who watches it more often would go, damn, no. I just can't help but think the guy who's been on top of a place that's done well in that economy has to be considered, you know?
Yeah.
Seems like a strong case to me.
Mm.
And just because I don't like that style of wrestling, I know it's gotten a lot of 5-star ratings. And, you know, some of those Dragon Gate matches have gotten really high marks, and... Mm. I tend to be the guy where, even if it doesn't appeal to me, if other people are going, I love this, I try not to argue with them.
Dragon Gate style is really interesting, because either you really, really like it, or you're not into it at all. So, I mean, that promotion, I mean, is different than, and he being the top guy in that promotion, that'll be interesting to see how voters vote for him, because it's a different style than any other promotion. I mean, it's very... high-flying, very Lucha-inspired, but in terms of him, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of Dragon Gate, so I wouldn't, like, be able to vote for him. But, I mean, I know when you talk about Dragon Gate, I mean, he's one of the top guys there, and he's been like that for many years. So it'll be interesting to see.
Japan. Now, on to Mexico, which I don't have a lot to say for Mexican candidates. There's not too much here. I mean, there's, you know, Pierre Aga Jr. is there, and Sin Cara. And there's, you know, like Hector Garza, Ultimo Guerrero. Really kind of the big kind of two, like the big one that I kind of see is, you know, Elliot Park. I don't really know if we talked about it before, and Dan said it multiple times, where it's not really in the kind of hall of very good. And that's kind of where I feel Lo Park is.
Yeah,
I just feel so bad about this category, and I feel like I've heard different people who are really heavy followers of Lucha argue before that a ton of these guys should already have been in years ago, but they're not, because Mexico's sort of... It doesn't necessarily cross over, because it's a very unique style of wrestling, and outside of Mexico, you know, every now and again there'll be like the big Lucha star who crosses over, who can sort of do an American style, like the Rey Mysterio type, or, you know, in a different era it was Mil Máscaras. I don't even think people would call Mil Máscaras Gary Worker, but he's definitely a big crossover star.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
But there's so many guys in Mexico that... especially on this list, where if you were heavily into Lucha, you would go, well, that's a Hall of Famer, that's a Hall of Famer, that's a Hall of Famer, that's a Hall of Famer. And so, I don't know enough, and I feel bad that I don't know enough, and I would just sort of defer to the voices of wrestling guys. I think Joe pretty heavily follows Lucha, if I'm not mistaken. And there's a fellow who posts around the internet by the name of Rob Viper.
He would know.
Yeah, if that guy tells you something about Lucha, I tend to listen.
Yeah, I mean, for me, a lot of what Lucha is, it was very, like, I was very hands-off with it. Like, I followed it, like, in the last, you know, 15, 20, 20 years, but I didn't really follow guys. I just kind of watched, and I think a lot of that kind of takes away. So I kind of feel the same way you guys do, where no one needs to hear me talk like an idiot about Lucha, being like, I know that name. Like, I saw Vampiro. I saw
I liked Vampiro, so that means he's a Hall of Famer. And he probably is. I don't know. I mean, everybody talks about that early 90s AAA was, like, the hottest promotion in the world, and Vampiro was part of that. So, Yeah,
I mean, for me, I didn't follow Lucha until recently, so I mean, I recognize a lot of these names, but I don't know their significance in Mexico. I mean, and a guy like Vampiro might have been a big draw, but I mean, how is that like Hall of Fame worthy? I mean, I wouldn't know. I mean, I've heard like a Dr. Wagner Jr. is a great worker, and I know L.A. Park was very charismatic, but and I like Ultimo Guerrero from what I've seen from him, but I mean, I know them on a superficial level. I don't know them in terms of, well, are they Hall of Famers?
So, that's kind of a big thing.
Yeah.
I think because the Mexican wrestling candidate, Dragon King Carl, he's a big Lucha guy, or is that somebody else I'm thinking of? Who's the big Mexican?
Steve Sims. Dr. Lucha.
Steve Sims. Yeah, I got him and Dragon King Carl mixed up. Steve Sims. I think it would be in the best interest of the Observer to create, like, a veterans committee for each section, especially the ones like Mexico and, like, Europe and Australia, Caribbean.
I think Mexico more than anything else.
But Mexico, I think, more than anyone. Like, a historical veterans committee and then a Mexico veterans committee are probably the most important because I think they're the most underrepresented as far as, you know, people that... when I hear the Lucha Libre experts talking, they're like, I can't believe this guy's not in, I can't believe that guy's in. So it'd be nice to see a veterans committee sort of built for the Mexican candidates to try to get guys who deserve to be in, because obviously we're not equipped to do it. And I think a lot of voters aren't.
Yeah, and some names, like, a lot of these names, you know, especially jump out at me as guys that I know, but I couldn't talk with them intelligently. Mm-hmm. I think that's basically... And outside of repeating ourselves over and over again, that's pretty much how it ends there. I do like the part of that. European candidates are kind of going to be an interesting one here.
Strangely controversial one every year.
What's up, Skull? Jim Briggs, Big Daddy, Horace Hoffman, Billy Joyce, Kenny Nagasaki,
Nagasaki.
Jeez, man, I don't know what to do today. Jackie Palo. Rollerball, Johnny Saint, Ricky Starr, and Otto Wands. Two names are probably going to be the big ones here, which are going to be, one's big for Dan and no one else, and the other one's for Daddy. Yeah, that's right.
I'm sure we'll spend most of this time talking about Big Daddy, so I just want to talk about the two guys on here.
Randall
Otto Wands. Otto Wands, I just want to mention because he's a legend in, all those English guys used to go work for Otto Wands' territory, when they were coming up, because I think he was based out of Austria or Germany, and they would go over there, and they had the same setup as the English, you know, with the rounds and the World of Sports style, and, you know, he was obviously a big star to be able to own the territory, so I think he probably deserves more recognition, but Rollerball Mark Rocco, if you haven't sat down and watched his matches that he had with Marty Jones, because they were booked. Both of them were light heavyweight, middleweight level wrestlers. And they wrestled each other maybe a thousand times over the years. The matches that got William Regal into wrestling. He's talked about this feud was the thing that made him want to be a wrestler, that made him, inspired him to do the way he did. They are amazing. It's that chain wrestling, quick style, but you know, sometimes you see guys chain wrestle and it's like in slow motion because they're trying to remember what they're supposed to be doing. It's amazing to me. I watch those matches and I go, those are some of my favorite matches I've ever watched in my life. And I have to put on the tape for Mark Rocco because of it. Because I kind of feel like it's weird for Mark Rocco to go in and then Marty Jones not to, because they're so indelibly linked, at least in my mind. But
he was also the first Black Tiger.
I think if you sit down and you watch those Mark Rocco, Marty Jones matches, if you sit down and you watch Mark Rocco, you'll go, oh, man, that guy's awesome. You know, why isn't he in a Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I remember him being the first Black Tiger and having that feud with a Tiger Mask, Satoru Sayama.
Yep.
And, I don't know if he was... I think he was pretty influential, like, in terms of chain wrestling and bringing the European style over to Japan. Would you say that?
Yeah, I would say everybody knows the Dynamite Kid Tiger Mask matches. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones everybody talks about. when you watch Mark Rocco, that's you're watching that before that, because it's the same, like, the cruiserweight, you know, cruiserweight level guys having these incredibly athletic but wrestling heavy matches. Not, you know, sort of the 90s athletic was the top rope stuff. This is more just getting on the mat, wrestling, going back and forth, and God, it's just amazing. It's amazing to watch, in my opinion. So that's why I would put Mark Rocco in, just because I think he's sort of one of the pioneers of that style for cruiserweight wrestlers.
Yeah.
Certainly the most, you know, I think if I had to choose someone from that list, it would have been Mark Rocco. I do remember seeing tapes of him as Tiger Mask in New Japan. That's kind of where I, or Black Tiger, sorry, not Tiger Mask. I mean, that's kind of where I remember seeing him. But more, you know, one of the big things, you know, here, please, Brian, explain to me and everyone why Big Daddy is awful and should never be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, I mean, there's a very big, I mean, the main source of talk about Big Daddy is on the Wrestling Observer board, where there's a very large European contingent who believe Big Daddy should be in, and they want him to be in very badly.
Did you see that picture?
Yes.
They know, people know who Big Daddy is. Yeah. That's all that really matters. It doesn't matter that, you know, he wasn't a huge draw all the time. Didn't matter that he was an awful wrestler for, you know. But
it didn't matter that he killed wrestling in England.
Yeah, that's why I can't, like, really talk about Big Daddy, because I don't know what... I know people like to talk about him. I guess he was, like, this big celebrity in England at one point, but... I don't know, like, how he did business-wise or what he did. I mean you bring up that he killed wrestling in England, but I don't know, like, the story behind that.
So part of the thing was that Big Daddy did have a time period where he was a huge, huge television star.
Yep.
And I think it would be sort of comparable to Sting in WCW, where nobody would think, they weren't selling a lot of tickets, but everybody was watching him on TV, because that was one of the things about, you know, we left out talking about Sting, is that crappy period of WCW did really well on television ratings. WWF was often beating them, but they were still drawing really well on TV. Eyeballs were there. Not necessarily putting asses every 18 inches, as promoters like to say. But, and he was having, like, these big Superman, or super heavyweight matches, and him and, what's the guy's name? The Giant Haystacks, I believe. Giant Haystacks.
Yeah, giant Haystacks. Not Haystacks.
Yeah, I get those two.
I believe he also wrestled.
Yeah. So it's just these two huge fat guys, you know, bopping into each other over and over again in a tiny little ring, because those English rings are so friggin' tiny, and you're like, how does that even hold them? You know, so there was a time where he was a star, and his brother owned the major English promotion, and he stayed on top well after anyone gave a shit. And eventually the English TV channels made the decision that wrestling was a little too low class, and they wanted to be more educational, because I think that's part of the English system, is that part of their licenses has to be rooted in having so much educational programming, because it's just a different system than we have in America.
I think from what I remember hearing, yeah, they switched the time when wrestling was on, and ratings fell big time.
The network that carried it, wrestling, and I can't remember exactly if it was ITV, they were wanting to make a concerted effort to get wrestling off their TV channel, because they wanted to get a little bit more high class, highbrow. Uh-huh. And so they moved it first so that the ratings would go down, and then they canceled it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And part of what made that an easier decision is that the ratings were going down anyway, because nobody wanted to see Big Daddy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So he made all that easier for them to make that decision. There's a little bit of, like, you know, WCW people will complain that Time Warner just was out to kill them, and they hated us, and they wanted to get rid of us. And it's like, well, when you lost $60 million the year before, it makes it a lot easier to make that decision. And that's sort of the same situation they were in with Big Daddy and whatever, and that, you know. People weren't coming anymore, and they weren't doing quite as good a business, and... The same thing happened with Doctor Who on BBC. It's like, the ratings are not doing so well, and we kind of like to put something else on here that's not such silly sci-fi bullshit. All that was sort of happening at the same time. You know, wrestling and Doctor Who went off at the same time. So, to me, that's Big Daddy's legacy, is that he had a good run and then stayed on top for way too damn long, and then eventually they lost TV because of him, in large part. And he obviously was a shit worker. I mean, I don't know anybody who's ever watched a Big Daddy match and went, oh boy, that's what I love out of wrestling.
And he fought a shit worker. Like, a lot of it seems to me that with the Big Daddy thing, it's a lot of it, it's like the biggest thing was him and Giant Haystacks. And the match was just a freak fight that, yeah, and of course it's going to draw. You know, the guy, one guy was giant, one guy had giant heads. But I don't think it doesn't make a Hall of Fame. That having that thing of that fight and being, you know, a well known name doesn't really make Hall of Fame.
That thing kind of drives me a little crazy when I hear about, but everybody knows what his name is. It's like, okay, yeah, it's called a Hall of Fame, but that's not what we mean. Like, Hall of Fame is sort of a thing, is the term we use. It's not literally who's the most famous, because if it was who's the most famous, then, like, well, I guess, you know, O.J. Simpson's the most famous football player.
It's not a popularity contest. Yeah.
It's not just do people know who you are. It's a popularity contest in the sense that wrestling is itself a bit of a popularity contest. If everybody pays to go see you, even if you're the dirt worst, then you've obviously figured out wrestling.
Yeah.
But if people aren't necessarily paying to go see you that much, and you're still being booked on top because you're the promoter's brother, and nobody, like, people just know your name, but they sort of associate you with silly bullshit. Not necessarily with, oh, this thing I love, it's all that shit that I don't watch. That ain't good, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, but you know what, if you were there, I'm sure you had some memories of him. But for me, and for us damn North Americans,
it's just so often when I hear people talk about Big Daddy, it's like, but I know his name. Well, yeah, I know Charles Manson's name too. That don't mean he's accomplished anything.
Exactly. Email us, Europeans. How about that? Come at me, bro. I'll totally deal with it. Won't fight
Big
me.
Big Daddy is Charles Manson.
You know what? I live in a better Halifax than Big Daddy did, so screw him.
And God, he looked like a creep in every photo I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That's just
all right. We're getting way past it. Is there any other of the European candidates we need to go over?
Well, yeah, it's sort of the same thing with Mexico with some of the names, because, like, Johnny Saint, I've heard his name mentioned by a lot of great workers, a lot of people, but I've never seen anything of him, so I can't say one way or the other. And I've never seen Otto Vance either, so I'm.
I've seen a little bit of Johnny Saint, and I like what he does, but I don't know a lot about him. And Otto Wands, I think, I don't know about Otto Wands. He was the big CWA promoter, right? Like, in Europe. What, wasn't he?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard about a lot of people going there, but I don't know how it did as a draw. So
I just know a lot of those guys used to say, like, a lot of English guys used to say, well, that's where we'd make our money, because there was no money to be made in England, because Big Daddy was killing all the towns. So the only place for them to go and make any money was to go, you know, work for Otto Wands.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've heard of Kendo Nagasaki, but I don't know if he's any good. I just know his name.
Yeah, I just know the name.
One I really know anything about was Ricky Starr, and that's, I don't know enough to, like, I know he had that, you know, huge undefeated streak, and, you know, he's kind of noticed out of that monster there, but I don't really know enough to say so. Speaking of not knowing enough to say so, there's the list of Australia, Pacific Islands, Caribbean, and Africa candidates, none of them which I know anything about.
Well, Carlos
Killer Carl Cox is sort of in the same position with me that I mentioned with, like, Red Bastien earlier, where it's, like, so many people who saw him work go, this guy was the greatest heel I ever saw in my life. And, like, you're, like, Dick Murdoch copied everything from Killer Carl Cox. And Stan Hansen goes, my God, I just wanted to be I just wished I could be half as over as Killer Carl Cox. And Gary Hart talks about him. And basically anybody who ever worked through Texas goes, my God, Killer Carl Cox. So that's kind of that to me is where, you know, if I had a vote, I'd put a vote in for him, just because there's so many people whose opinion I trust going, kill Carl Cox. And, you know, when you see a guy who ends up in all these territories that are doing really well, there's kind of a reason, you know, he's not ending up in those because of, you know, because he knows a guy, because you couldn't end up in all those places. I think I don't like Carlos Colon, so just emotionally,
nope. No one does.
Fuck that guy.
That's why he's not in.
Yeah, fuck that guy. Oops, I don't care. Fuck that guy. But you look at Spyros Ryan and Mario Milano. They were the headline talent baby faces of that Australian promotion. You know, the Australian Jim Barnett WCW for all those years, and they put asses in the seats to come see him because. When, you know, there was a lot of great heel talent that came through there, though. You know, all that great American talent, whether it's Harley Race, or it's Carl Cox, or it's Brute Bernard, who's also on this list, or Mark Lewin, or, you know, Gary Hart as a manager, or bam, 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 bam. When those two guys stopped being pushed as the top baby faces, the shit hit the fan. And a lot of that was when the Tennessee guys, Jarrett and the Continental guys, all came in and bought the territory from Jim Barnett and ran it into the toilet because they're a bunch of rednecks and didn't understand why anybody would want to see a bunch of Greeks and Italians wrestle because they don't know anything about Australia. You know, I think that's like 40% of the population is Greek or Italian. So I think the fact that the territory went under not long after those guys stopped being the focal point, I think sort of says a lot about how important they were. But again, it's just not enough people followed Australia, and they're sort of lumped in with the Caribbean and the Pacific Islands and Africa, apparently.
You'll
so.
Take these scraps.
I mean, Mark Lewin, wasn't he with Kevin Sullivan at one point?
Yeah, he was a long time heel in a bunch of different places with either Gary Hart and I think most people would know him because they were on Florida Championship Wrestling with Kevin Sullivan there toward the end of Florida being a thing. But he was an old guy by that point.
Okay.
Like, he was in his 50s at the time he was doing that stuff with Kevin Sullivan.
Well, I do have one question before we move on. I mean, about Carlos Colon. I mean, we know his role with Bruiser Brody and all that, but if you put that aside, would you say he's worthy of a vote?
Probably for the same reason I said of the stuff about Mario Milano and Spyros Ryan. I mean, he's at that level. I mean, he's the local superstar babyface that everybody put the asses in the seats to come see him in his area.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but fuck that guy.
I don't know.
And he was a terrible worker by every argument I've ever heard.
He wasn't a good worker. He's very, very, very small in what he was doing, and his promotion was...
He's a batter.
And he sucked, and he was awful. And I hate his guts, and he's a dumb poopy head. Anyway. That's Australia. Here's our informed. That's very well informed. Now for it's probably the most fun category, which is the non-wrestlers. So let's go down. I'll go down this list, because it's actually what we talk about. So Bill Apker, Dave Brown, Jim Crockett Jr., and Jim Crockett Sr., Gary Hart, Jimmy Hart, Howard Finkel, Jerry Jarrett, Larry Montesk, Bill Monsoon, Gene Okerlund, Don Owen, George Scott, and Stanley Weston. So let's just start with a question. We'll start at the top. So is there any chance that a Bill Apker is going to get into a Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame?
If he didn't by now, no, because we've gotten to the point now where there's enough voters who didn't grow up reading those magazines.
Yeah. I mean, it's based on if you think that... What you think about the Bill Apker magazines of the 70s and 80s and all that. I mean, if you think that they had a big influence in wrestling, then I think he would have been voted pretty quickly. But, you know, now he's been in there for a few years. I don't think the chances are good that he'll be voted in because, you know, the list of people who get votes changes every year. And I mean, like, somebody like me, I got my vote last year, and, you know, growing up, I didn't really read any of the wrestling magazines because by then it was the internet.
The thing that kind of killed those after mags was when WWF started their own magazine, and then none of the WWF guys could get on any of them.
Yeah.
It just became the NWA magazines, and I think that just sort of limited their relevance.
Yeah.
I think if they had had that kind of relevance that they had in the 70s on into the 80s and the 90s where everyone's on them, maybe we're talking about a different situation. Yeah. But when every week you're saying whoever is being pushed against Ric Flair is the best guy in the world. I don't know. To me, like, Dave Meltzer came around and put all those guys out of business anyway. Like,
yeah,
why would
true.
You give a shit about Phil after making up fake storylines when you can just read Dave?
They still do kayfabe to this day. It's pretty...
I actually didn't know that.
Like, in an era where there's no kayfabe, that's pretty amazing.
I know. PWI... I have a 40th anniversary of WWE issue where they sort of kind of walk around it and they kind of talk about match play. Like, they'll do things like, well, he didn't face enough baby-faced challengers. And it's like, what? Like, what are you talking about?
It's a well-known magazine, but it's also, it's kind of silly. I don't think it's...
If they had the kind of penetration that, like, the Japanese wrestling magazines have had, because those magazines were legitimately influential, like, where... You know, like, half of all wrestling fans were reading them. The After magazines never have that. Ever. They were always more of just, like, this... you know, they did okay, but they were never, like, Sports Illustrated for wrestling, which they obviously tried to be. So, whereas the Japanese wrestling magazines, like Gong, I believe, was the big one. And they had a few. They had a bunch of competing ones. It was like, yeah, this is huge. Everybody reads these things. Yeah, if you're a fan of Japan, you read these. After didn't have that, and I think that's the only way I would put him on here, is if he was that kind of influential.
Yeah.
Now, Brian, why do you think that the Crockett's aren't in the Hall of Fame already?
That's a very good question. I mean, I don't know much about Jim Crockett Sr. to talk about him, but I know Jim Crockett Jr. was... I mean, he was the guy that put... Crockett Promotions on the map. I mean, he took the Mid-Atlantic territory and he made it really hot for a few years. I mean, really, really hot with Ric Flair, and you got all these great workers at one point, and that was the catalyst for Ted Turner buying WCW in 1989. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in terms of that and what he did for that, I think he should be in. But I don't know why people haven't voted him in. I mean, there's probably more to it that I don't know about, but I think just based on... And I think it's because of the fall of Crockett Promotions, I mean, because they had to sell a Turner for a reason, and that's because they blew a lot of money. But, you know, just in terms of the rise of Crockett Promotions and how he bought out Mid-South and I think Florida, too... I mean, he was one of the first to get TBS then to be on cable. I mean, I don't know if he was, like, involved in that in the late 70s or mid-70s, but I knew...
Georgia, and he had the whole thing where, like, WWF bought Georgia, or Vince bought Georgia, and then he did a deal with Turner to get the time slots back for an NWA territory.
Yeah.
Because Turner wasn't liking what Vince was putting on.
Yeah.
So...
You won't hear that on a Monday Night Wars, but yeah.
I think the issue with Big Jim Senior, they always called him Big Jim, huge 6'5", 350-pound guy, is it wasn't that big a territory. Like, it was a nice territory that made some money, but it was so far down in the pecking order. Like, it was below Florida, it was below Amarillo, it was below the... Texas, the other, you know, Texas was split into two promotions, Amarillo and then originally Houston, and then it got moved to Dallas. It was below San Francisco. It was obviously way below WWF. It was below AWA. It was probably below, at certain points, the Sheik's territory in Detroit. Below Dick the Bruiser's thing in Indianapolis for a while. It was probably below the Tennessee territory for a good bit. But it was a nice territory that made some money. So I think it's hard to say Big Jim is a Hall of Fame worthy promoter when, okay, he was made money. But he was also, like, a lot of what the Crocketts were into was, like, owning baseball
stadiums. He was also awful.
No, I don't think Big Jim was a bad guy, was he?
I mean, I'm talking with their failures, kind of.
Well, Big Jim wasn't a failure. Big Jim was successful at everything, but a lot of his money was coming from owning racetracks in North Carolina and owning baseball stadiums, and they had a hand in promoting a lot of things, and wrestling was just one thing Big Jim did. Obviously, when Big Jim died, he died of a heart attack. A guy named Big Jim had a bad heart. Can you believe it? The guy, Jim Jr., didn't actually take over the business originally. It was the husband of their daughter, of Big Jim's daughter. And then he got caught stepping out on the Crockett girl, and he was sent away. That's all I have ever heard. He was sent away, which sounds ominous. And that's when Jim Crockett took over.
That's what they're going to talk on season 2-1 serial.
Yeah, so, yeah, what happened to the Crockett, to the guy who married the Crockett daughter. I think part of the strike against him is that he was incredibly reliant on his booker. Jim Crockett did not have a great understanding of the wrestling product.
It's a great point.
George Scott was the booker of that company from the day that Big Jim died until 1982 when he had a fallout with Jim Crockett. And I will be one of those guys, and we'll get. I'll bring up George Scott now because he's also on the list. I think George Scott is a Hall of Famer for what he did in Crockett Wrestling and then in WWF.
Yeah.
It all fell apart for him after he left WWF, and it was maybe falling apart for him while he was there, and it sort of masked by how well everything else was running.
So did a lot of... I don't think after, like, because I think a lot of those, like, 80s...
Yeah, wrestling changed so much.
Yeah, and just look at, like, you know, like, all of them. Like Bill Watts, like, things like that. Like, they just... They hit the 90s, and then shit just—they couldn't do what they did before. So I don't think that's.
It is unprecedented for a booker, because the way it used to work as a booker is you'd be there for like a year or two, you'd go through all of your ideas, and then you'd move on to the next place, and then do your ideas that place. You know, most guys had about 1 or 2 years worth of angles that they sort of had in their head, and they'd seen it work here, and they'd seen it work there, and then they would go to the next place. And George Scott was the booker of that place for almost 10 years. And he's the guy who brought in Steamboat, and he's the guy when Flair came in. And all this stuff is when George Scott was a booker. And part of why George Scott was a great booker is that he wasn't the guy who had to sit around and be, well, this is my idea, and we're all going to do it. George Scott's brilliance was that Wahoo's coming in. Okay, Wahoo, what angle do you want to do? What's drawn money with you? Who do you want to do your angle with? Blackjack Mulligan, what angle do you want to do? What's drawn money with you? Ric Flair? He let his top talent book their own angles, and then George Scott was the detail freak who would go, okay, that's a good idea. We're going to tweak this, 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 and this, and then it'll make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And then, because Mid-Atlantic Wrestling under George Scott was the, if you are an obsessive, detail-oriented person who doesn't like anything that looks fake or silly or stupid, George Scott's Mid-Atlantic is your wrestling company. Because that place had the most airtight, detailed storyline where you couldn't poke a hole in that thing if you tried. Mm-hmm. And that's George Scott. And there's a lot of wrestling companies that have never come close to that kind of logic in their booking. And so I think that kind of takes away from Jim Crockett Jr. that he had this guy with him. And then when George Scott leaves, their business went down. Mm-hmm. And then Dusty came in and it went back up again. But he had to rely almost all on Dusty.
Yeah.
He didn't have the control on Dusty because he was used to George Scott, who he could just leave alone, and George Scott made him money every year. Dusty, you had to be on Dusty's ass to make sure he didn't bankrupt you.
Yeah.
That's so much money. And the things that Jim Crockett should have been in control of that territory, because obviously his bookers were doing the booking, he should have been the guy looking at the bottom lines. And he didn't even realize he was running out of money until his one accountant for this national television wrestling show. He has one accountant working above a former 7-Eleven in Charlotte, because that's where they never moved the home offices from, where Big Jim had the home office. his one accountant tells him, oh shit, I just got done doing all of our numbers for the last year. I was 9 months behind. We're broke. You know, in the summer of 1988, he finds out that he's broke because of the, you know, the Starcade stuff that everybody's talked about with Vince screwing them on Starcade.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing. It's like, why, you know, if Crockett was a better promoter, he maybe could have gotten that deal done with the cable companies, because at the end of the day, Vince's threat was pretty hollow. Like, oh, I'm not going to let you put WrestleMania on. Oh, really? You're not gonna make money yourself? You know, Crockett's inability to go, really? You're going to really think he's going to do that? Like, that's a mark against him, because everything about Crockett was the business side of things. Because the wrestling product, he really didn't put his hands on that much.
Okay.
And that's the stuff that killed the company. That's all under Crockett's, that should have been where Crockett's eye was, is the stuff that put them under.
Yeah, just as a business standpoint, I mean, it seems pretty... George Scott was involved in getting the Mid-Atlantic and later Jim Crockett Promotions hot. And I would like to ask if... How long did George Scott run the WWF in terms of booking?
He was the booker there of record, I believe, from like 84, because he was in Canada when he left Crockett.
Okay.
Part of the deal was that George Scott left the Carolinas, but he was still working there, but he was booking two territories. He was booking, because George Scott's Canadian, and okay, he was booking Toronto, which was right around that point where Toronto switched from being an NWA city to joining Vince. So that was the Tunnies, yeah. You know. Jack Frank and Jack Tunney. And Crockett got convinced that George Scott was going to lead them to WWF, so he fired George Scott and basically pushed them to Vince. When if he maybe would have dealt with that a little bit differently, maybe Toronto would have stayed an NWA town.
Yeah.
And then that's when George started working for WWF. And he's the guy, the reason why, I mean, WWF has changed the history because Finkel still works there. George Scott's the reason why it's called WrestleMania. Finkel came up with the name, but it was George Scott who sold the name to Vince and said, this is what the name has to be. This is the name, WrestleMania. Vince's idea was some ludicrous bullshit, if I remember correctly. It was like Challenge Fest. Like, it was something really stupid.
Star Challenge.
Yeah, it was a really dumbass name, and George Scott's the reason why WWE will always be in the wrestling business, because they're never going to figure out how to take WrestleMania, have changed that name. That brand's too locked in.
And I mentioned George Scott because would you say that he was involved in getting Hulk Hogan into a big star?
No, that's Hulk Hogan and Vince.
Okay.
I don't think George Scott was like some creative genius where it's like, I'm going to come up with some great angle for you or some great gimmick. I think his genius was more being able to work with people and keep egos happy and make everything make sense.
Okay.
So he's kind of always the perfect guy to work with Vince, because Vince always has needed that guy who's like, okay, Vince, that's an idea. You and the top talent came up with that idea. Let's detail that into making sense. Because obviously you watch WWF, and they've had many periods of time where they haven't had that, and it just looks like the dumbest shit on TV. You know, Vince doesn't have somebody he respects telling him to mind his details, the shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
And George Scott was that guy for Vince when they started.
Well, just to cap off on Jim Crockett, I mean, would you say that the fall was bigger than the rise? Is that might be why he's not voted in?
I think he gets blamed for that fall.
Yeah.
But the other thing you gotta give Jim Crockett Jr. credit for this is Vince sort of was taking over the wrestling business from the outside, and Crockett completely took over the NWA from the inside. Like, by 85 or 86, the NWA was whatever Jim Crockett decided it was. Like, he had completely taken that thing over from the inside, and he used Vince as sort of the outside threat, but he owned the NWA for all intents and purposes, because all the other promoters had left. And part of the reason why they left is because they all found out Ric Flair was going to be staying the champion, whether they thought Terry Von Erich should be, or whether they thought, you know, what was the other big territory at the time? World Class, sort of the NWA territories. World Class was, Mid-South wasn't in the NWA, but I'm trying to remember. But it was mainly World Class left the NWA because Fritz found out none of his boys were going to get the belt long-term over Slayer. Because Crockett had been the guy who'd gotten into the NWA and basically said, I'm the guy you need to be behind. Not Fritz. Fritz is a moron. And the few NWA promoters left went, yeah, he kind of is.
Yeah.
So, give Jim Crockett Jr. that. You know, he did take over the NWA when the NWA still had something to give. When the NWA brand still meant something. Yeah. And that's why when WCW came into being, they had the NWA legacy, because Crockett had managed to take that over. So he does have his strong points, I think.
Yeah.
Now, Dan, do you think that because Gary Hart's book wasn't fully distributed, that's one of the reasons why he's not in the Hall of Fame?
Okay, I don't want to mess up here. I think that's one of the big reasons. I think the other reason is because him and Dave hated each other.
You mean in the book itself? What do you mean? What in that?
I think Dave, for many years, wrote about him in a negative light in The Observer, and Gary Hart certainly had a lot of things to say about Dave at the point that book was published. But before that book was published, I think a lot of people knew Gary didn't like Dave.
I didn't even hear about this until right now.
They hate each other. I can't say Dave hates him. I Dave, I don't think is a huge enough fan. I don't think Dave's a huge fan of him.
Yeah. There was some back and forth with Dave, sure. I mean, it's one of those kind of well documented things. And
I think one of the issues is like the first guy in the wrestling business who really reached out to Dave and was like, okay, come sit under the learning tree, was Paul Bosch, who was the longtime promoter of Houston. And Paul Bosch and Gary Hart hated each other. So one of the guys who's formative in teaching Dave a lot about the wrestling business hates Gary Hart. Well, I mean, I've had people that I've trusted who mentored me, and their enemies have a funny way of becoming your enemies, too. And a large part of that is because the Houston booking office that Paul Bosch worked in for 20 years before he was running Houston used to be the NWA booking office. That used to be the most powerful place in the state of Texas as far as wrestling. With the Houston booking office, and then Fritz took it over, and the guy who helped Fritz take it over was Gary Hart. So you can see where Paul Bosch and Gary Hart might not get along. And Gary was usually the one in charge of telling Paul Bosch he couldn't do whatever Paul Bosch wanted to do. So that kind of friction, and then Paul Bosch having an influence on Dave, you know, that is what it is. But I think Gary belongs in the Hall of Fame. When you look at the places Gary worked, it's like a who's who of what territory is getting hot. And I'll be damned if every time a territory starts getting hot, it's Gary Harding right there in the middle of it.
Also a great manager.
And as a behind-the-scenes guy. He was rarely ever the head booker. The only place he was really ever head booker was Dallas, and it was a smaller territory as far as roster size. But he was almost always the assistant booker. You know, he's the guy who was there when Dusty Rhodes turned babyface. He was one of the main creative guys in Australia when it was doing really well. He was there when Dallas took off. You know, he was there during the Atlanta Wars. He was a major part of the winning side of the Atlanta Wrestling War. You know, all these different places. He was one of the guys who helped book Starrcade, the first Starrcade. Yep. So every single time you're looking at these huge monumental places in the history of wrestling, and I'll be damned if Gary Hart ain't sitting right there in the middle of it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember him most as the Great Muta's manager. I mean, I know he's done a lot of stuff before that. I know about his stuff behind the scenes, but I just remember him being a really great manager. And I think if I read his book, I would like to know more about him. I mean, like you say, his book is out of print and can't really get it anywhere. But you know,
he has cut so many people.
Yeah,
he has stabbed so many people. So many people have been on the end of his blade. I think that maybe that hurts him too, because so many people either got threatened by him or actually cut by him. But the other thing, Dave's a big guy with Jerry Jarrett. Gary Hart, according to him, almost threatened to cut Jerry Jarrett's eyes out with a blade right at his face. There's a lot of people Dave's friends with that Gary Hart did not get along with.
Yeah, but I would like to learn more about Gary Hart if I decide I want to vote for him or not. I mean, I just know he was a really great manager, a great promo.
And he came up with that gimmick. I mean, the Muda gimmick and the Kabuki gimmick before it, because Muda was sort of like the son of Kabuki.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He invented that gimmick. Like, he was, you know, Gary Hart, in a lot of ways, when he would manage a guy, he would do their gimmick. It was like he was their personal booker. So, you know, a lot of the talent he's associated with, those were guys he was working really, you know, really closely with, helping them do their matches, helping them figure out how they should work and how they should do their gimmicks. And I think because of his influence, you know, some people say he wasn't a great manager because after that, you know, he was in the other plane crash of the 1970s, and he kind of lost a lot of mobility after that.
Yeah, so
he wasn't like the animated Jim Cornette, Bobby Heenan style manager.
Yeah. Yeah, he couldn't take any bumps.
But he could talk.
Yeah.
He's evil son bitch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, speaking of kind of the announcers here, the two there, Howard Finkel and Gene Okerlund, what do you guys think?
Finkel?
I'd almost say Gene, yes. And
I would say definitely yes for Gene Okerlund. I mean, he was able to get any... I mean, when you look at WWF's promos, there's some great promos in WWF in the late 80s, but there's a lot of crappy promos too. And Okerlund was the one who was able to make control the interview and was able to really get great stuff out of people. I mean, he was very tremendous in that one.
I think Okerlund could make a shoe sound like an interesting
thing. Yeah, definitely. I mean,
he was a terrible, like, calling a match announcer. That wasn't his role. He was a backstage ring. He was a ring interview. He was an interview guy, and he was great at it. And I don't think it's a huge shocker that their interviews have gone to shit since they lost guys who are like Gene Okerlund, because now their idea is just hire some like bland 20-something year old who's to just stand there and smile blankly at people while they do a promo and frown at them with their head.
Like, what's the line that all the interviewers say? Like, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, talk about.
Talk
about.
Yeah,
the one thing that they
this.
Teach you now as a journalist to never ask anyone is to talk about. Never ask talk about questions. That's the WWE, where talk about is still considered a good idea.
They're all taught the same boring style, and Okerlund wasn't that at all. He was very.
Okerlund was a broadcast professional.
Yes.
Went into wrestling.
Yes.
Because he was a radio guy before that, and you can tell he's just a pro.
Yeah.
He knows how to make anybody sound interesting, and he knows how to interview people.
I mean, I think later on, I think people might look at him and go, well, he kind of, like, takes over the interview maybe a little bit too much, and later runs, like, in WCW, I think people accuse him of that. But and if you look at his career overall, I mean, he was pretty damn awesome throughout everything. I think there's even talk that he was even better in AWA. I mean,
everybody says he's better than AWA.
He was.
Yeah, and he was already pretty great in WWF, so.
I think he slowly became Gene Okerlund, the character, and in AWA, he was just the interview man.
Yeah.
But I would argue in WCW, a lot of times where people would say, oh my God, he's Bigfooting the guy he's interviewing with, he's making him. Because the guy couldn't do anything. You know, if you're sitting there talking to friggin' Chronic. Yeah, you better start talking because Jesus, this is gonna die otherwise.
Like,
true. As territories broke down, and one of the things about the wrestling business is territories broke down. A lot of the great promo guys died off because that's a skill that you learn by doing it.
Yeah.
And once we got into this era where we had the two mega companies and then one mega company, there's nowhere to go learn how to do that.
No.
So guys are a lot rougher, and having a guy who could save the segment, even if it didn't make the guy look that great, at least save the segment.
Yeah. The thing about today is, I mean, with promos, it's like you're given a script and you have to learn lines, and you can't deliver it like it's actually you talking. When back then you could talk, even when you talk, it's not like it's great or anything, but at least you're saying your own words.
Yeah, but if you go back to the 80s, those guys all learned how to do that in some small territory where they were allowed to be garbage, and then have somebody over them going, that ain't right, kid. You know, in the 90s, a lot of those guys needed scripts, because otherwise it would have been a bad television show.
Yeah.
So I understand why the scripts have come in. I think they'd be better off trying to find another Gene Okerlund and having them just lead guys.
Yeah.
So, I would vote for Okerlund as a non-wrestler.
Yeah, he has my vote, for sure.
Howard Finkel, like, you're a ring announcer, man.
Yeah.
Like,
really great one.
The best ring announcer in the world. I did that when I was 14 years old. And I'm not saying I'm Howard Finkel good, but if I can do it at 14...
I mean, he's definitely a voice that you know, but I don't know. Any time he went outside of that, it was awful. That Jericho thing and getting kicked in the balls by Leon Garcia. Just not good memories.
I wouldn't vote for him.
It's like, he's the greatest timekeeper of all time. Nobody ever rang a bell better. It's like, well, okay. But what's the difference between a bad timekeeper and a good one? Is it that big? Is it really that big a gap between Howard Finkel and Justin Roberts? I mean, maybe Chimmel, because Chimmel couldn't speak without tongue-tying himself.
Yeah.
You know.
Finkel does blow all those guys...
Yeah!
Finkel blows all those guys out of the water, but, I mean, how do you judge what...
But does he, or do we just say that?
I think he is. I think he's way better than them.
I don't think
I think if we were kids in the 2000s, we wouldn't notice any difference. We'd just go, well, that's what I grew up with, so it's great.
I just think they had a better voice than them.
Where it's just not that important.
Yeah,
I don't care if I'm kind of fan.
It all depends on what you think a ring announcer is in a Hall of Fame, and I don't think a lot of people think that that's worth a Hall of Fame vote.
It's almost like you were the best setup man on a baseball team. Man, nobody pitched the eighth inning better. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's basically it. Now, that's basically all I had for non-wrestler stuff, to big deal. I mean, Girl Monster's not a good announcer, but no. what other guys have you?
I will say I think Don Owen is only on this list because he paid really well. So Portland was never really that strong a character. I mean, obviously, he had a great run with Roddy Piper, the big doughboy, Playboy,
Buddy Rose.
But it was never a big money drawing territory. I don't think it would ever be considered for this if Don Owen wasn't just such a nice guy who paid wrestlers a pretty good percentage of what the gate pulled in. So there's probably a lot of influential people today going, put Don Owen on there. Put Don Owen on there. Jerry Jarrett is the opposite. Jerry Jarrett absolutely should be in the Hall of Fame. Dave mentioned it before. Jerry Jarrett is unquestionably one of the greatest promoters ever, but he was a piece of shit to the talent. So
when they're voting for you.
Yeah,
that's probably why.
You get votes when you were a real asshole to that talent. You know, he absolutely was exploitive thief. But that's what a promoter is in a lot of ways. And he made a successful territory as a booker and as a promoter in a place where they don't have much population. People talk about Jerry Lawler. Well, he's the guy who put Jerry Lawler on top. I mean, he's the guy who made the deal to split the territory and go off on his own and then win a wrestling war, which obviously was always a tricky situation. You can't say enough about him as an intelligent promoter. And once Jerry Jarrett no longer had anything to do with Memphis, that's when it really went down. You know, when he sort of sold out of it and became just the Jerry Lawler show. Obviously, Jerry was older, and the wrestling business had changed a lot. But you got to look at Jerry Jarrett and go, well, he had the sense to know this was the time to get out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Dave Brown's also on the list, because if you bring up Jerry Jarrett, you got to bring up Dave Brown and Lance Russell. Dave Brown's an excellent announcer, icon in the city of Memphis.
It's weird because Lance Russell, without a doubt, is a Hall of Famer, and I think you're on the first ballot. But I mean, and everybody remembers when it comes to Memphis wrestling is the Dave Brown and Lance Russell combo. But what? Do you think that's enough for Dave Brown to get in? I mean, it's kind of weird.
I think it maybe should, because part of what made the Jerry Lawler wrestling show work is that they didn't just pick up and split away from the Nashville-based, you know, the Tennessee wrestling office used to be out of Nashville. I can't remember the old asshole's name. He was a real thief, and he was the one with the fat son that they were trying to push as the main event. But they were on the station in Memphis, was the station where Lance Russell and Dave Brown worked for. I think it was the ABC affiliate in town. And it wasn't just Jerry Lawler's moving to Channel 5. Wasn't just, you know, the Jerry Jarrett promotion. They brought Lance Russell and Dave Brown. Dave Brown became the weatherman at the station. Lance Russell became the program director at that station. Lance Russell became an anchor at the station. Like, everything. Like, the whole damn, I think it was Channel 13, which was where the wrestling show was, it all switched to Channel 5. And when you talk about the success of that promotion, it ain't just the talent. It was that Dave Brown became the weatherman at that TV station. Lance Russell moved over. Those guys had so much trust, so much faith in the Memphis audience that they were bound to succeed. Because you look at Memphis, and there's not a lot of talent that went through there. It was basically Jerry Lawler,
Hill the Week,
a lot of short guys who couldn't make it in other territories who could work with Lawler because Lawler wasn't the tallest guy in the world.
No.
So you had guys like Dutch Mantel and Bill Dundee who could never get over anywhere else because they were like 5'7". Who could get over working Lawler because they didn't look so.
It was pretty much like a revolving door of heels who would come in and challenge Lawler, and then once the money ran out, which was very quick, they'd leave and another guy would come in.
Yeah. But when you look at that territory, it's a lot of shit talent, but then Jerry Lawler on top getting great matches out of whoever, and Dave Brown and Lance Russell are always there telling you this is what you need to watch. I think that. That's why I would put Dave Brown in the Hall of Fame, because that territory was so dependent on this rotating cast of nobodies coming in and getting a wacky gimmick to wrestle Jerry Lawler. And if you don't have announcers to sell those gimmicks and to sell those guys as top talent, even though if you kind of looked at them with objective eyes, you'd go, that guy's a pile of shit. But those announcers are making them out to be the gods on earth coming to fight Jerry Lawler, and he's got to slay these dragons.
And really, when you think about it, I mean, without Dave Brown or Lance Russell or either of those guys, then you had like the Corey Macklins and other guys selling. I mean, it's like night and day.
Yeah.
I mean, those two, Lance Russell and Dave Brown, were just fantastic, and nobody could reach their level.
Dave Brown and Lance Russell made that thing have legitimacy.
Yeah.
A lot of times they did a lot of silly shit.
And if
you don't have those two guys there, then it's like a parody of a wrestling show.
Oh, yeah. When you see some of the stuff Memphis did in like the late 80s and early 90s, that was pretty stupid stuff. And you have to give it to both Lance Russell and Dave Brown, and that they were able to give some sort of credibility to that. Because it was hard to do.
So I would say because of how important they were to the success of that territory, and because of how successful that territory was, I think Dave Brown belongs in. I mean, he would have my vote if I had one.
Yeah, he probably has my vote. I mean, I have a ballot, so I'm going through all these lists. I mean, it's pretty hard to determine who gets a vote and who doesn't, but this category, probably Dave Brown and George Scott and... Jerry Jarrett. I would probably vote for those three.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably Oakland and...
Oakland, yeah.
And Jerry Jarrett.
I think Jimmy Hart's kind of an interesting guy in this bout. Because Jimmy Hart, again, was amazing in Memphis. Maybe one of the best managers in the world. And then he went to WWF, and he was so clearly not as good as Heenan.
No.
Like, clearly not as good as Heenan. And on the same show as Heenan. And at the same time, Jim Cornette's over on the other show. So two of the greatest managers ever, and these are your contemporaries. They're not like Paul Heyman. I think sometimes benefits from the fact that there's nobody else doing what he does.
Yeah.
And Paul Heyman's a great promo, but he doesn't really add much to the match. Not the way that like a Jim Cornette or a Bobby Heenan did. But he's a great promo, and there's nobody else doing it. So you look at Paul Heyman and you go, yeah, he's the best manager. Yeah, and he gets put on lists with those guys. Like, he's his best. Like, he may be, some people say he's better than them. Jimmy Hart didn't have that benefit because he's being directly compared.
I mean, his WWF run, I mean, he is very memorable, and I think he he was pretty all right, but it's nothing like compared to what he did in Memphis with Jerry Lawler.
If he would have had the kind of run at WWF like he had in Memphis, he would be a Hall of Fame.
Yeah, without a doubt.
He just didn't, so...
And his WCW run sucked.
WCW basically just...
He was full of crappy people.
Yeah, he was just Hulk Hogan's buddy. Who got a job because Hulk Hogan
died. All his promos were exactly the same. He didn't say anything. Look at him, baby! You're not supposed to be here! But yeah, it didn't work for me. And that's all I remember him by is that WCW stuff.
Oh my god,
the
NWO's here, guys! Come on, NWO!
And him to go... And he was the manager of the Nasty Boys, like, and he tried to make me, he tried to tell me that they were great, and I don't care if, I don't care if they're face or heel, don't try to lie to me.
Yeah. He was supposed to the Dungeon of Doom.
We're gonna walk all over your faces! He's like, oh god, the Dungeon of Doom, and he's walking over nobody's faces.
No. No, but, I mean, if he had, like, a longer run, and, had, more memorable feuds in Memphis than, or like,
I will say, everybody, when you're done with this, go to YouTube and search for Lance Russell's Nose, which is a song Jimmy Hart. Because before he got into wrestling, Jimmy Hart was a musician. He was in a band.
His entries.
Yeah, he wrote a song making fun of Lance Russell to get heel heat, and it's the funniest damn song in the world.
Yeah.
Lance Russell's Nose.
Yeah. If he had more longevity as in Memphis, I think it would have. I think he would be more of a lock.
And if Vince's idea of a Southerner wasn't a cartoon retard, like, I think he would have done better. Because, like, he in Memphis, he was like the slimy record producer type. And that got over. But when he gets in front of Vince, he's like, all right, you're a moron.
Here's this microphone.
Screams over and over again into a microphone, and then you hang out with a honky-tonk man. Because you're both from the South. That makes sense. And, like, the whole, like, oh, he's a slimy record producer, and he's slick, and he knows all this stuff about how to make money, and he's making these music videos. Like, that all just doesn't even get included. And that was a big part of Jimmy Hart's E. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Poor Jimmy Hart. Some of it's his fault, some of it's not.
But it's hard to feel bad for him, considering how many years he had in business doing nothing.
Yeah, great for him. Good for Jimmy Hart. Whatever. He shouldn't probably be hanging around with that Hulk Hogan character. I've heard a lot about him, but
and then Larry Madison, the assistant booker in St. Louis for all these years, and he's a big Dave. You know, Dave still has him on. But he had a stroke recently, so that's sad. Our thoughts and prayers are Larry Madison. I don't know. I'm not as familiar with St. Louis wrestling, and I don't know if you guys are either. But
no.
Nope. You know, it's hard to really say, and it's hard to know how much. Dave's kind of made it seem like a lot of that was Larry Madison in the later 70s and 80s, but it's hard to tell, you know, how much was Sam Muchnick and, you know, I mean, Sam Muchnick's a legendary figure in wrestling. He's basically the guy who spearheaded the creation of the NWA, so it's hard to tell how much is just, Larry Madison being his errand boy, you know, that sounds mean, but you know what I mean. It's hard to separate.
Yeah. And with that's pretty much it. That's a list of, we talked about a lot of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I know, Brian, you said you had a ballot.
Yep.
I can't talk to that, I swear to God. So I'm sure, hopefully we helped that somebody out who has a ballot. Probably not. But I'll write my pretend ballot, and I'll seem really cool and popular.
It raises a lot of questions. I mean, some of the guys on here, I mean, I think I have a better idea if I want to vote for them or not, but both of you guys brought up a lot of good points on some other guys I thought for sure I would vote for. I did vote for last year, but now I'm not even that sure. So it does raise a lot of questions, and it does get you thinking overall.
I think that kind of speaks to why some of the modern guys sort of get left out, because there's so many, it seems like there's a glut of Hall of Fame caliber non-wrestlers who just don't get enough votes to get over the top but sort of stay on the ballot because they should probably be in.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many of them all at once that it's hard to sort of sort them out. And there's so many, you know, Hispanic wrestlers from Lucha who are sort of clogging the ballot because they're all great and they just don't have enough people who saw them.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely. It's something that requires a lot of research. Especially if you you don't know a lot about Mexico, or you don't know a lot about anything like before the WWF got big. I mean, it requires a lot of research if you want to vote for this authentically. Not just you want to vote for Big Daddy because it's a fun thing to do on the F4W boards. You know? But, yeah.
We shall not be. We shall vote for Big Daddy every year. That's his theme song, guys.
Copyright Fire for Wrestling Podcast.
Do you guys remember one guy on the board who wrote a letter to some sort of political figure over there in Europe, and they actually gave a letter back? I mean, that was genuinely amazing.
Some good stuff. But yeah, so that's pretty much it for there. Hopefully you got someone out of it there. It's a lot of wrestlers, so I'll be interesting to see. A lot of the Lumley Southern talk kind of made me want to go back and take a look at it there. But, you know, I'm sure we've already talked your off and up there, so it's about a 3-hour show. So
our longest episode.
Yep.
2 hours, 30 minutes.
Yeah. So that's up there. We'll actually be next week, we promise.
Yeah.
There won't be anything crazy happen. Or will there? Who knows? Dimitri,
I hope to die.
Yeah, I hope to God. No, anyway, so that's it for now. We'll see you next week. I'm not really sure what's going on next week, but we'll figure it out.
I think we might go back to the part 2 of our video game series.
Yeah, I think that's going to be next there. Looking at N64, basically. Yeah. PlayStation, that 64-bit kind of era. So let's talk about... So it should be fun, but until then, we're going to call it it's an afternoon, but we're going to call it a day. For everyone out here, I'm Brad.
I'm Brian.
I'm Dan.
And we shall see you later. Bye!